I've had a dumb idea.
Oh, I can't wait.
I want to know when my garage door has been left open in the evenings. It doesn't happen often, but it's something that does happen.
Isn't the whole purpose of your, you know, smart home garage door opener to alert you to this? Like, when you mention that you got one of these smart garage things probably 3 years ago, I believe you specifically said this is what it's for, is to like alert you if you leave it open unnecessarily. So is it not doing that like in its own app or automatically?
Well, here's the thing. As with everything in my life, nothing can ever be simple. It always has to be difficult. So I did have the Chamberlain MyQ add-on, almost daughterboard, if you will. And so what that is, if you're not familiar, is it's two pieces. It's a, I can't think of the term, but it's like a thing you stick to the back of the garage door so it knows whether it's up or down, right? It has like, not, I don't know if it really has an accelerometer, but it has like mercury switches in it or something like that. Oh, such that...
an accelerometer is probably cheaper these days than mercury.
Actually, you're probably right. I don't even know. But you get my point, right? It's something that sticks to the garage door so it knows if it's down, or which is to say vertical, or if it's up, which is to say horizontal. And then there's another box that basically proxies a network request to RF. So you can come in via the internet and say to this box, I would like the door to open, please. And then it just emits the same radio frequency signal that a traditional garage door opener that you hold in your hand would emit, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you can add it to almost any garage door opener. And I had that for a while and it was great. And then when I was at WWDC 2 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago now, our garage door, which had ever, ever, ever so slightly buckled, really buckled, and it wouldn't open or close anymore. And so when I came back from WWDC that year, and again, this is like 2 or 3 years ago now, we decided to get a new garage door, and with that became a new garage door opener. Now, I thought to myself, self, you have this new fancy garage door opener. You have the opportunity, I should say, for a new fancy garage door opener. Why wouldn't you get a new fancy garage door opener where all of this functionality is built right in? You don't need the little dingus on the door because it's the garage door opener is fully aware whether the garage door is up or down. And the garage door opener is internet connected. Everything will be peachy and great. As it turns out, the particular vendor that we used for our garage door sold us the most awful smart garage door opener in the world. So it does have an app, and it is possible I might be able to configure that app to alert me whether or not the garage door is open when I go to bed. But the app is so bad that I don't trust it to do so. And so I have gone down the path of trying to like man in the middle this thing with Charles on the phone to see if I could like figure out their API and just kind of work this out myself. But as it turns out, the one and only thing the Linear Pro Access app does well is some sort of certificate pinning or something like that, such that I can't sniff it with Charles. Like I'm talking a bit outside my comfort zone at this point. I'm not entirely clear what I'm talking about, but it does seem clear that Charles doesn't want to show me what I want to see. So now what? Well, I've got a hammer, and it's called the Raspberry Pi, and everywhere I look, there are nails.
Oh, no.
So what I've decided, the only reasonable answer is to get two more Raspberry Pis, because why would I use the one I have when I can get two more?
To be fair, they are so cheap that you can do that.
Well, right. That's the thing is I don't need like the big honkin' Pi 4 that I have for like, well, I don't even need that for Pi Hole, but that's what I'm using it for. And I don't need it for my VPN. Like I'd probably use one of the Pi Zeros for any of these things, but I do want the Pi 4 for emulation, as we talked about a few episodes back. So I thought to myself, well, I could get a Raspberry Pi Zero wireless or Zero W, whatever they call it, which is literally $10 for the board. This is an entire Linux computer for $10. Plus, you know, potentially plus shipping and so on and so forth. So I thought to myself, what I can do is I can put a Pi Zero somewhere near the garage door and get one of those magnetic, I forget the term for it, but one of those magnetic switches where there's a piece on the garage door and a piece on the door frame, right? And when those pieces are very close to each other, the circuit is closed. And then when the door moves away, thus the door is open, the circuit is opened. Then what I can do is in my bedroom, I can put a second Pi Zero, and then I can hook that up to an LED, and the LED will come on when the door is open, right? This is flawless. And so this afternoon, I started like writing Python for the first time in probably 10 or 15 years. And I figured out how to do like multicast UDP between two computers. Like I don't have any of the Pi zeros yet. I haven't actually committed anything yet in terms of financial investment. But I, you know, I could send UDP messages between the two computers so that they can, you know, talk to each other. And then just before the show, I figured out how to flip one of the GPIO, which is one to say one of the pins on the Raspberry Pi that you can use for input or output. I figured out with Python how to make it go high or go low, which to be fair is extremely simple, but I'd never done this before. And so now I'm looking into like, okay, how do I, on the sensor side, what script do I need to write such that it'll see when like the voltage is falling or perhaps if the voltage is peaking. And so I can get a callback and interrupt, I guess, in order to figure out, okay, now I need to send this multicast message to the other Raspberry Pi. And I am sure that there is an infinitely simpler answer to this. However, the one thing I'm not terribly keen on is having to wire something from the garage to my bedroom, which is silly because I won't mention publicly that the bedroom is literally right over the garage, but I don't want to have to go through walls and whatnot in order to wire everything. So why not just put two $10 computers, one on either end, and poof, it all works via the magic of wireless. Problem solved.
Why not just install two $1 mirrors?
Because that, what am I gonna do, cut a hole in my floor or like stick one out the window?
Yeah, do like a basically like a periscope kind of arrangement. Like have one out the window that you can see that's angled, you know, 45 degrees, and then below it have another one angled 45 degrees that looks at the door.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could, but that's no fun, man. It's not as much fun.
It'll work 100% of the time, never need software updates, doesn't depend on your connection.
It's just no fun. And a lot of people are saying, well, why not use Homebridge? Well, I'd love to use Homebridge, but there is no Homebridge interface for linear garage door openers. There is for the Chamberlain MyQ that I used to use. And before everyone asks, we'll just use the Chamberlain MyQ in concert with the linear Pro Access. And number one, no, I don't want to do that. Number two, I gave the MyQ away. So either way, I can't. In my effort to use a Raspberry Pi for even the things that it is so unbelievably unnecessary for, I have considered doing exactly this. And you can't put any of this in the show because I don't want to get well actually for the rest of my life.
So Ryber in the chat has an even better suggestion. You can just use one mirror. If you just install it at the end of your driveway, you could just look at that. And then you could see, you know, you wouldn't see it as closely as my Prism setup, but it would be even easier. You could probably put it on your mailbox as long as you screw it on instead of stick it on.
Possibly, yes. Although given our last week's conversation about the Homeowners Association, I'm sure they would have things to say about a mirror showing up on my mailbox. Anyway, I just really wanted, I all kidding aside, like, I have every confidence that I could do this without any sort of computing hardware whatsoever and probably have some sort of magnetic switch and a power supply and an LED and wire that all through the house some way, somehow. And it would be way more reliable and it would probably work forever. But I don't know. It just seems like less fun. And one of the things that makes the Raspberry Pi so appealing to me, and presumably an Arduino would work for this too. I just don't have any experience with that personally. But one of the things that makes it so appealing to me is the idea of just doing something that's unusual and different for me. Like I never play with hardware. I think both of you potentially, or certainly Marco, you've played with hardware a lot more than I have with like your RFID scanner that you did a couple years back. And I'm sure there's other examples I'm not thinking of. Yeah. Well, like all barely, your retro though. Gaming stuff.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, this is an itch I have never really scratched. And I kind of want to try it just to see if I can do it. And it may end up that it doesn't work for beans. Maybe there's something that I'm not thinking of that will cause it to not work at all. Maybe it'll be deeply unreliable. Or maybe I'll just realize, yeah, okay, this is really cool. I like having this LED in the room that shines when the garage door is open. But why do I need two, you know, internet connected, or well, network, you know, intranet connected computers to do this? I could just use a couple of frickin' wires. So I don't debate that there are better ways of accomplishing this goal, but I do debate if there are more fun ways of accomplishing this goal. So here we are.
Never underestimate the smart home for the ability to introduce needless complexity and unreliability into what should and always has been very simple tasks and roles of objects in your home.
Yep, it's so true. I don't know, like, all kidding aside, if not a Prism scenario, if you had to do something that involved some amount of electronics, now that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi or something like that, how would you solve this problem?
I just don't leave the garage door open. I mean, first of all, how often are you leaving the house right now?
Well, that's true too. That's also true.
I mean, we have a garage with a, you know, with an electric door, and we, you know, move the car into it when we arrive, and then we close the door behind us. And when we want to leave, we open the door, back the car out, and then close the door and then leave.
But that's the thing, is that oftentimes we will open the garage door for the purposes of letting the kids play, or maybe even pull a car out so the kids can play in the garage and the driveway. So I take your point that our cars are not leaving the driveway very often, but the cars are leaving the garage semi-often. And occasionally the cars won't leave the garage. We'll just open it up, play for a while, come in, and maybe just leave it open because there was no compelling reason to close it at that moment. And it's very rare, truth be told. I think it's only like 3 or 4 times a year that we have left the garage door open overnight, but it annoys me. And this would be a neat way to fix it, a neat, uselessly complicated way to fix it.
That will sometimes mostly fix it for a little while.
Yeah, exactly. Until something breaks. A very good question also from Ryber in the chat. Do I have any old phone jacks in the house I could piggyback off of? I do in general, but I don't anywhere in the vicinity of the garage that I'm aware of. So it's a good idea. But no, I don't think I have anything. So I am not necessarily looking for input about this, because really it's an excuse for me to do something stupid. I acknowledge it's stupid. I acknowledge it's uselessly complicated, but I think it would be fun. But so other than just not forgetting, you haven't really given me an answer. Is there any electronic equipped way that you would consider doing this?
Me? No.
Yeah. Or John, but I'll start with you.
Okay. One thing I've wanted for a while, which could solve this problem, but it's not really meant to be like a fixed thing. I've wanted basically a something that was, it's almost solvable by a baby monitor. And I don't know if this exists. I've looked around a little while and couldn't find it. So what I want is a battery-powered camera that I can stick somewhere with like a suction cup, like a GoPro, you know, like you know, a small battery-powered camera that I can move around the house easily, and a small video monitor that can show what's on that camera live. And they're both portable, wireless, and, you know, would just have batteries. And the idea here is sometimes I need to keep my eye on something, and it's somewhere around the house or something, but it's not always the same place. So one example might be if you're doing a load of laundry. I would stick the camera in the laundry room looking at the machine. Mm-hmm, so you could see whenever you want, I mean, how much time is left? What's the status of the machine? Similarly, if I'm like roasting coffee and I want to like, you know, go, you know, do some work during the boring first 10 minutes of it. Or if I'm like, you know, cooking something in the oven or on the grill that takes a long time and I have a thermometer. Yeah, they have wireless thermometers. They suck. And I have a nice wired one. So I could just like, you know, have this looking at the thermometer screen and I could be in the office watching the video screen. Stuff like that. Common needs. And there's lots of like IP cameras, and then you run an app on your phone. That all is garbage and it sucks, and I hate it. I've tried those. They're terrible.
Yeah.
And what I want can almost be solved by a baby monitor, except that usually the camera side of it is like, you know, AC powered only. And then the monitor itself is, you know, kind of free to, you know, roam around with batteries. I want this product to not use the internet at all. I want it to just be based on RF. Like, just give me like, you know, 2.4 gigahertz, you know, just like good baby monitors are. So it's just instant. There's no service involved. There's no giant latency. There's no service fee. You know, just a freaking piece of hardware. And hardware is so cheap these days. I assume that has to be easily possible, but I haven't looked too much into it. Anyway, that same thing could do this if I had one in the garage. That being said, I just closed the garage door.
Well, and generally speaking, we really are pretty good about this. This isn't like a chronic affliction, but it's something that, I don't know, it happens once in a while, and this would be a fun little challenge to see if I could fix it. This is very MacGyver-y, but for those of us who are old, a very MacGyver-y solution, but I just think it'd be fun. John, you've been very quiet. I can hardly wait to hear how you would solve this problem.
I need a Raspberry Pi to let me figure out how the hell to get logged into our stupid IRC server with my supposedly registered nick. It's because of this new IRC client. Like, it's disconnection between me and IRC. Like, I do /nick and put a name in it, and it's just like nothing happens. Sometimes something happens. It's driving me nuts. For your garage door stuff, just close the garage door, JKZ. Just You don't have too much truth. How much do you have to remember in life, really? Make sure both of your children are accounted for. You have two of them, so count heads. One, two.
But that didn't work on Home Alone, man.
Remember to feed them. Remember to clothe yourself, bathe, you know, do all the things. Close. You remember to close the front door to your house? Or do you leave that open a lot, too?
No. Close, yes. Lock, very rarely we forget to lock it.
I think we just got to climb the ladder of things the Casey has to remember. He remembers to close the front door, not always to lock it. The garage door is still working on the remember to close. What I would look for is a solution for this that would just, instead of being like, let me know if the garage door is open, just close the garage door at the time in which you think the garage door needs to be closed for the day, whatever time that is. Like, I have a thing on my lights that says just turn off all lights at like a certain time when I'm like, look, the day is over. And if I've somehow forgotten to turn the lights off, just turn them off. Right. And I know that is complicated because it's like, well, it just has one button. And when you press it, when it's closed, it opens. And when you press it, when it's open, it's closed. But I believe in your ability to solve this problem. That's what I would do. I don't want to know if the garage door is open. I just want it to close itself if I've left it open.
That's fair.
I don't even have a garage door opener, by the way. Mine opens with the power of muscles. So
really?
Yeah.
Because it's broken or because that's the way it's always been?
Because it's broken, yeah. Spoken like someone who lives in a development made in the 90s. No, not because it's broken, Casey, because there has never been a powered way to open and close my garage door.
So remember that Mac Mini that I was going to order for my Studio B upstairs?
Oh, yeah.
Got that in. Long story short, I had to return the first one. It had a problem, but I got the second one in today. Installing, setting everything up. I, for the first time in a while, set up a completely new installation of macOS without importing from anything, without importing from your previous laptop or anything like that. And I had to install from scratch for the first time in a while Dropbox. Now, Casey, I know that you have not had the Dropbox app installed for some time.
Yeah, a few months now.
And it had been a while since I had seen the fresh install. The way I run Dropbox is, first of all, reluctantly. Second of all, I run it without its stupid kernel extension. So I don't use Smart Sync or any of the other like stuff that requires the kernel extension. I don't give it accessibility full permission over my entire system.
Wait, pause. How do you not install the kernel extension? Is there a point in which they give you the option not to?
I'll get there.
Okay, carry on.
So yeah, I don't install the stupid kernel extension because I don't want, that sounds crazy to me and it's not worth the risk and instability that could introduce. Dropbox is not a company that I trust to write good software. Simple as that. And also, no extension, no accessibility, full access because, again, it has no reason to need that, in my opinion, for the things I needed to do. And there's also a dialogue every time you reboot, usually, where it tries to get you to give it your system password in a dialog box that looks like the system password dialog authentication box, but isn't. Basically, it, you know, it's tricking you, and it's horrible security practices, right? So, I never give it that password. On a fresh installation, doing this fresh, they have made it harder than ever to achieve this setup.
That's not surprising.
The stuff they do is so misleading, so incredibly unethical. It's just so many like dark design patterns. It is so hard to get through that installation without giving them full access to your entire system at the kernel level and giving them your admin password and giving them accessibility full permission to look at everything you're doing in the system. It's absurd. So I have never in my life been more angry at Dropbox than I am this morning and today. I've decided I'm done with them. I am going to quit Dropbox. So I wanted to ask you, Casey, mm-hmm. how you've done it so far and how it's working out. Because really, like, it's just malware at this point. Like, it is more invasive to your system than most malware would be. And most malware wouldn't have the guts to do what Dropbox does. it's so bad. Oh, like, I'm so offended by the horribleness of what Dropbox does and how much it tries to insert itself into every single part of your system for reasons that mostly benefit them and not you. It's just absurd. And so I'm done. So what is the world after Dropbox like for you? How did you get there and how have you been finding it?
It is important to understand the context for what I'm about to say, which is, as I've said many times over the last couple of months, one of the best worst things that has come from all my computer problems is that my computers are basically ephemeral at this point. Like, I could lose one of them and really, I'm sure I would, I don't doubt there'd be some file somewhere that I would miss. I'm sure there would be. But in the grand scheme of things, I would be fine. Like if this iMac Pro just took a dump right now, I can't think of anything that I literally could not live without. And I do have backups, but at the same time, like even leaving those backups aside, I can't think of anything that I would be like, oh no, you know what I mean? And that's the same with my laptop. And, you know, other than not having a phone, it's really the same in my phone too. I think on my phone, I would lose a couple of weeks worth of pictures potentially if they're not in, in my photo stream, but that's about it. So
wait, hold on. You still aren't using iCloud Photo Library?
No, because reasons. We can belittle me about that another time. I deserve it, but we're going to set that aside. So my computers don't really have anything extremely critical on them. And the only stuff that's really, really critical that is on my computers is either in a Git repository that is, you know, synced with GitHub, or in Synology Drive, which is my replacement for Dropbox. Now, Synology Drive suffers from the same problem as Apple TV. When I say Synology Drive, I can be referring to one of 34 different products and 75 versions of those 34 different products. And it is infuriating. But there is a client that you can install on macOS, and the UI is not stupendous. It looks like it's a Java app or something like that. But the good news is I never see the UI for the most part. Like I see the little thing in the menu bar and that's it. Like I never really see the UI. I never really interact with the UI. Because why? Because it just magically is part of Finder, like Dropbox used to be back when it was good, back when they didn't give a shit about work chat or whatever the stupid things are that they're doing. That's like Evernote, which also went down the toilet. So it's very similar to Dropbox in the days of yore when Dropbox was still good. It is not perfect. The iOS apps in particular, like they function fine, but their integration with the iOS Files app is very janky from what I can tell. To be fair, I haven't tried this in a few months, but as an example, I am a super nerd and I like to keep a log of every time we put gas in our cars. You see, Marco, some of us put old liquefied dinosaurs into our cars and that's how we propel them. I know that's very barbaric, but some of us are still living in the past. And
that's not the part that sounds like the past. The part that sounds like the past is you're keeping a gas log.
Well, that's true too.
Like it's one thing if it's part of your work that you know get reimbursed for fuel. No. That's not true for you.
Nope.
Okay. All right.
So anyway, so leaving that aside, but what I'll do is occasionally
we're leaving
I'll be
so many open tangents.
I know. God willing, we'll forget all of them, including me. So what I'll occasionally do is, you know, especially if like I'm with Erin and she's filling up her car, I'll want to take my phone and go to my number spreadsheet that is stored in Synology Drive and edit it using the Files app. So, you know, I'll load the Files app, go into the Synology Drive section, find the numbers file I'm trying to edit, open it up in numbers on my iPad or iPhone. And like 8 times out of 10, I'm looking at a several version old version of that file, because I think that was the last time that the Files app within my iOS device opened it. Does that make any sense at all?
Yes.
So that kind of sucks. So if you're relying on integration with the Files app, last I checked, not great. But for Macs and for the Synology Drive app on your iOS device, if you're not involving the Files app, it works pretty much flawlessly. And I probably should be a little clearer about what it is. It's basically hosted Dropbox where the host is your Synology. So all your files exist on your Synology. It'll replicate them between all your devices in real time. And it seems to, as far as I can tell, work extremely reliably in that capacity. The only downside I see, well, there's two, I suppose. One, you don't know which friggin' thing you have to download and what you need to install in the Synology to get this version of Drive. And it's very frustrating in that regard, because there's so to speak, not literally, there's Drive, Drive Plus, Drive the hardware to drive device, Drive the software, Drive the old software, Drive the new software, Drive for iOS. You know what I mean? It's like the same thing as Apple TV. Oh, with Apple TV, the hardware, Apple TV, the software, Apple TV, plus the service. It's preposterous in that regard. That's the one downside. The other downside is Files app integration in iOS is a little eh. But other than that, like especially if you're just viewing this from a keeping my Macs in sync perspective, and then maybe every great once in a while I'll look at something in the Synology Drive app on your iOS device. Chef kiss, it's good to go. I don't know why I haven't done it already. The question I really need to ask you too is, are we going to choose to move to iCloud shared folders to pass MP3s between each other?
No.
I don't trust it. I just don't trust it. It had such a rough launch. I think it's going to need even more time of it just being boring and working for everybody all the time before I will really trust it.
All right. Well, then you can do what I do and load Dropbox.com every time you need to upload a file, because that's how I do it. I do not have Dropbox installed on any of my Macs. It might be on my iOS devices. It's been so long since I've touched it, I don't even know, to be honest.
Well, on iOS, it's safe, right? Because I know, like, this is one of the advantages of the iOS extreme security sandbox approach is you can trust that there's not that much bad stuff that any app can do. And if you wanted to get rid of it, you could just delete it and it's all gone. But you know, like, you know, I as a developer know that the Dropbox iOS app can't do almost any of the stuff that I have a problem with. Like, it really can't do any of it, actually. There's very little ability for it to do anything that would even be remotely shady on iOS. Yet on the Mac, it basically behaves like a rootkit. And and it's like one of the most popular pieces of software in the world. It's gotten worse and worse. So the good thing is they have recently rewritten their sync engine. So whereas before it would just consume one entire core when you're like doing anything else in the file system that isn't even in the Dropbox directory, like unzipping a new Xcode, you know, in your downloads folder or whatever, it would just consume one core. Now they've made it so that it can consume multiple cores of your computer when you're not even doing anything with Dropbox.
Delightful.
Yeah. So they really expanded the scope of the amount of resources it can suck from your computer for no good reason. Yeah, I'm getting rid of it. Like, I've already decided I'm done. The only question is, like, what do I do to fix, to alleviate some of these needs for it that I've had?
Oh, and the other thing I'll say with Drive is that I haven't explored doing any sort of public file sharing. So I don't think it would be easy for you and me to share, or the three of us to share files, unless I like had you guys I created accounts for you guys on my Synology, which, I mean, I can, but it seems a little bit overkill. And then you would have to like point Drive, because it seems like you can point Drive at several different destinations concurrently. And so you would have to point Drive at my Synology, at our shared folder, which again, like, we can do that, but it's nowhere near as easy as Dropbox, where you basically say, take this folder, share it with that email address, and just make magic happen. Because again, back when Dropbox was good, that was one of the great things about it. You could just say, share this folder with Marco and John, and poof, it's shared. And that I do miss, although in my case, the only thing I'm ever really sharing with anyone, I guess because I'm a jerk or because I work alone, is files with you two, or files with Mike. And I'll just go to the Dropbox website for that.
So this may seem like a dumb question, but why don't we just use like FTP? Like, I have a server. I have many servers, actually. Like, why don't we just why don't I just like set up a folder on my Marco.org server? And just set up like an SFTP server there, and that's where we put our files. Like, is there, you know, like, obviously this kind of solution doesn't work for people who need to interact with a whole bunch of other people. But for us, when we're mainly interacting with the same very small handful of people who are all nerds, like, why don't we just do that?
I mean, you certainly could.
Doesn't the Finder have native integration? Like, couldn't you literally have like a thing in your Finder sidebar that just was, we just call it the ATP Dropbox or whatever, and it would just go there? Like, wouldn't that work?
You're afraid of using the Dropbox offer and you want to use the Finder's FTP integration?
You make a good point.
I don't know if that still even exists, but I would really not trust that code. I would use Transmit or something, and then I'd have to launch another app.
Oh yeah, I would use Transmit too, but you know, it'd be nice if there could be like, of all the many different protocols that Finder does support for various network and internet shares, it would be nice to use, maybe, like, does WebDAV, is that still a thing that exists?
No, I'm not using
it.
WebDAV
does exist. It like, does exist.
Yeah. So, like, you know, maybe we could just do whatever the heck WebDAV was. I still am not entirely clear.
SFTP is the homegrown solution, but, you know, whatever. it gets annoying for if you're not just using it as a literal Dropbox, you know, where you're just dumping things in. The two-way syncing and the always liveness is the feature you want. I mean, you can use OneDrive for Microsoft. Google has a solution. There's lots of companies make products similar to Dropbox.
But see, I feel like if I'm gonna like finally leave the you know the experience and network effect of Dropbox, I don't think I really want to just go to another thing that's just like it, also run by a giant enterprise-y company that wants probably to do more stuff with my system, at least now, if not in the future. So like, first of all, I'm not gonna install Google software, because even trust issues aside, I've heard nothing but horrible things about Google's like system demons that you have to install for things like their photo uploader and stuff like that. Like, everyone says they suck.
Yep, they do. Or they did a year ago anyway. I can't speak of recently.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they're better now, but probably not, right? Like, just like, you know, maybe iCloud Drive is better now. Probably not. So like, I'm not super keen on that. And yeah, Microsoft too. It's like, you know, Microsoft probably does a better job than Google, but I can't imagine it's good necessarily, like in absolute terms. So if I can avoid having some kind of always running persistent demon by one of these giant companies that has a lot more interest than just syncing a folder, I'd rather avoid that if I can. So that's why I like looking at something like either just using the Dropbox website or using Transmit's built-in Dropbox client functionality. If that still works, I gotta investigate that. Or, you know, using just like an FTP server, I'd rather do options like that.
You know, if all you were doing is sending MP3 files with iCloud, shared iCloud folders, I personally would be fine with trusting it as long as that was not the only place that these files existed. You know, so as an example, when I upload something to Dropbox, I am uploading a duplicate of that file to Dropbox. So if Dropbox just went poof in a cloud of smoke, it's not like that file disappears. You know, and if we made a gentleman's agreement that we weren't moving the only copy of our recordings into the iCloud shared drive, but rather a duplicate, like, whatever. I don't think that would be a problem.
Yeah, copy, not move.
No, it would be a problem, because the problem would happen is that you'd copy it into there, and then you'd go to sleep, and then Marco would be like doing an all-night edit, and your file would have been corrupted or half-written or overwritten itself or missing entirely, and then he's trying to wake you up for you to try again to copy it because your copy didn't work, and of course you don't see those because you're asleep and have Do Not Disturb on, and then you wake up in the morning with 20 frantic messages from Marco who couldn't make the show.
Isn't the potential for that the same no matter what option you pick?
No, because that's the whole thing with iCloud Drive, that half the time like your files disappear or were there briefly and aren't there or are replaced with older versions themselves or disappear entirely or stop updating on your end but don't. That's the whole thing, like the reliability aspect of it. Just because Casey thinks he successfully copied it and it looks like it's done doesn't mean it shows up on your end. That's the whole, you know, occasionally you have to like sign out of iCloud and nuke all your data and log back in. And, you know, that's that debugging procedure, especially if you use iCloud Photo Library, you don't ever want to sign out of iCloud on your Mac.
Oh, forget it. No.
Right. So that's, you know, oh, I don't know why it's not syncing. I copied it into my side. And then Marco's like, well, I don't see it over on this side. And then, you know, no to iCloud Drive. SFTP, yes. iCloud Drive, no.
Well, for what it's worth, I would hope that Marco would be privy to, or at least aware enough to call me twice in short succession if he needed to wake me up to get this file in an emergency. Because
I would never do that.
And then you'd still have to get the file. You're like, well, I copied it. What else should I do? And then you'd say, I don't know, let me just try Dropbox. And then it would sync and then get your file.
Well, that's true. I should say that a lot of people, when I was exploring this before I started running Synology Drive, to my recollection, and I'm seeing it a lot in the chat, other than the like Google Drives and Office, Microsoft Live, whatever thing that Microsoft does, a lot of people said both Nextcloud and OwnCloud. To be clear, I know basically nothing about either of them, but I did hear a lot of people say that both of them are very good. So if you wanted something, Marco, that was not self-hosted, or I'm assuming they're not self-hosted, they very well may be, it ultimately doesn't matter, you know, if you're interested in this, Marco/listener, look it up yourself. But those are other options. I think personally for the three of us, yeah, like I would be okay to try iCloud Drive, but I would also be perfectly fine to SFTP it or SCP it or whatever somewhere.
We are sponsored this week by ExpressVPN. Go to expressvpn.com/ATP today. Now that a lot of us are working from home, it's even more important to choose a VPN that you trust. ExpressVPN does not log your data. Lots of really cheap or free VPNs make their money by selling your data to ad companies. ExpressVPN has a technology called Trusted Server that makes it impossible for their servers to log any of your info. And many VPNs slow down your connection or make your device sluggish. With ExpressVPN, internet speeds are always blazing fast. Now, they say you can stream HD quality videos with zero lag. And I can personally say I did that when we were traveling out of the country this past winter. We wanted to watch a show that was not being served to the country we were in. And so we just used ExpressVPN to switch over to the U.S. and we were able to watch our U.S. video account outside of the U.S. and watch our show. And it streamed perfectly, flawlessly. It was fast. There was never any quality hiccups. I was shocked, honestly. Like, as a nerd, I thought for sure would there be some kind of sacrifice because it being relayed back and forth. And nope, there was no slowdown, no lag, full quality video streaming, and it was totally fine. And unlike other VPNs, ExpressVPN is really easy to use. You don't have to put any settings in or program anything. You just fire up their app and click one button to connect. If you want to disconnect, click another button, you're off. It's so easy, anybody can use it. Wired, CNET, The Verge, and many other tech journals rate ExpressVPN as the number one VPN in the world. So protect yourself with ExpressVPN. Go to expressvpn.com/ATP today and get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/ATP. Once again, expressvpn.com/ATP to learn more. Thank you so much to ExpressVPN for sponsoring our show.
Ready to start the show?
let's start with some follow-up 39 minutes in.
I mean, technically, that was Mac Mini follow-up for me.
Good job.
all right. John, tell me, how is your new video card?
It's big. New video card is big. First, we're waiting for this package to arrive. It got delayed again. It actually came today, as opposed to like almost a week ago that I expected it to come. And I knew it arrived today, hearing it like land on my doorstep, apparently thrown from the curb. I'm not sure how far away this thing was thrown, but like landed on my doorstep so loudly that I could hear it across the house. I'm like, I guess my package is here.
Oh, God.
Thank goodness for Apple's very sturdy, very cool packaging, you know, and double boxing. And anyway, it seems to be intact. When I was installing it, just for people to know, this is the Radeon Pro W5700X. With 16 gigs of RAM, it's a single GPU, it's AMD's newish GPU architecture, but it's a workstation-ish card. Anyway, you can look up the specs. So it's 4U. It takes up four slots on the back of your poor PCI slots on the back of your computer. That's how high it is, right? So the card just goes in one. It's an MPX module. So it's got PCI connector, and then it's got this other connector that it gets like power and other crap through. Anyway. There's two of those things inside a Mac Pro. There's an MPX slot at the very, very bottom, and then kind of in the middle-ish, there's another MPX slot. Those are the only two places in the computer you can put one of these MPX modules that has the two big honking connectors on it, right? Lots of other PCI slots are plain old cards, but these MPX modules can only go in those two spots. So right away, I'm faced with the decision, do I put this thing in the bottom slot, where my old 580X was, or do I put it in the middle? So first, I took the 580X out. So now there's nothing in there. And I'm looking at the options, and I'm like, if I put it at the bottom, like it's right next to the power supply, maybe it would be better if I put it in the middle, because then it would be like power supply, empty space, big honking GPU, empty space, CPU. With the, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to do that. I took out all the little spacers, which are really cool, by the way, the little black covers for your PCI slots. Those are nice. Those will be worth a lot on eBay someday. I'm going to save those for my kids' college fund / retirement. And I put it in the middle, but once I had it in the middle, I realized it's not really well lined up with the middle fan. I was hoping it would, like the middle fan would blow directly onto it, but it was more like it was catching like either the top or the bottom of the middle fan, and I didn't really like that. So I took it out. After putting it in the middle, I took it out of the middle. And I said, all right, you're going to go in the bottom. It's the only other choice. So I put it in the bottom, and that seemed better lined up with the bottom fan. The bottom fan is blowing like right on the new GPU. All right. So, you know, even though it's up against the power supply, that's the best option, which is interesting because if you think about, you know, the three fans are sort of evenly spaced in the front of the computer. The top one is very well aligned with the CPU heatsink. It's that big giant fan and then your CPU heatsink. But the bottom two are not really well aligned with any of the slots. Anyway, so I got the thing in the bottom, and then I've got the 580X outside the thing. And I was going to pack away the 580X in the packaging that the big one came in and just put it in my attic, but I was like, you know what? Let me try sticking it in this computer too. And, of course, I only have one choice of where it goes, the other MPX slot, which just so happens to be, you know, basically touching the thing. So it's like the the 4U thing and then the 2U. Even the 580X is 2U because both of these GPUs have gigantic front-to-back, top-to-bottom heat sinks, right? They're, you know, there's no fans or anything in there. They're just all giant heat sink fins. So I put the 580X back in. What the hell? Closed the whole thing back up. Turned everything on. The absurdity of my computer now is that if you look at the back of it, I have, by my count, 10 places where I can plug in monitors. 10. Like, and I can drive 10 monitors. Like, no problem. I've got two GPUs in there, and I can drive 10 monitors off this thing. I think, I don't know, how many 6Ks can I do? I think I can do 3 6Ks, and then 7 5Ks, maybe? I don't even know. Anyway, there's an absurd amount of places where I can plug in monitors, and I have one monitor to plug into it. The interesting thing is I can plug that one monitor into a lot of different places. My new video card comes with 4 Thunderbolt ports on the back, right? Plus 1 HDMI. So I have the 4 places just on that card where I could plug in the monitor. I assume all those ports are the same. I hope I'd have it in the fast one. Anyway, then the 580X, interestingly, has no Thunderbolt ports on the card itself whatsoever. It just has 2 HDMI. And then I have the whatever, 3 or 4 or Thunderbolt ports that are part of the little I.O. card. And apparently I can plug in my ProDisplay XDR into any of those ports as well. And when I plug it into those ports, the W5700X runs the monitor, right? Even though I'm not plugging it into the card, now with both GPUs installed, if I stick my monitor into any port that is not directly on the 580X, then the 5700X wins and gets the monitor, which is confusing to me because I was like, what if I want to run my 6K monitor off the 580X? Apparently, there's no way for me to do that, period. I can drive other monitors off it, connecting it directly with HDMI. But anyway, so I'm not quite sure if I'm going to keep it in this config. It's running this way now. My monitor is actually connected directly to the 5700X in one of its many Thunderbolt ports. Seems fine. Doesn't seem like it's any louder. I checked the fan speed with the beta version of iStat menu that shows me fan RPMs. They don't seem to be any different than they were when I just had one GPU in there.
You are running iStat menus?
I'm not running iStat menus. What I do with iStat menus is I install it, check the fan speed, and then I uninstall it because that's the only way to really, really turn it
off. Oh, my God, John.
No, there's a giant switch in their settings thing. You can turn it all off like with a master switch.
I don't think so. I can't check because I don't have it installed anymore, but I'm sure like you can't ever actually turn it off. Only uninstalling does. Anyway, it's not installed anymore, but I took screenshots of fan RPMs and graphs and everything. Maybe I'll try it differently with just one thing. But I'm assuming the 580X is literally doing nothing now because it doesn't have any monitors connected to it. It's not being asked to do anything. And I'm hoping there'll be some piece of Apple software or video toolbox that Handbrake will use. I'm hoping something somewhere will use this extra GPU that I have in my computer. If not, it's just sitting there probably wasting electricity. So too bad. So what did I do with my fancy new graphics card? I booted into Windows, which was an adventure in itself, because, of course, I boot Windows. It shows the little Windows 10 logo, you know, the little blue-teal logo that Windows 10 shows on boot. Then the little teal logo disappears, and nothing ever appears on my screen ever again. So that was great. I used to think, and this used to be true, that Windows has to handle all sorts of weird, exotic hardware. So, worst case, it'll just, like, fall back to VGA or some crap. It'll be like, look, I can't make heads or tails of any of your hardware. I'm just going to fall back to the safest of safe modes and just, you know, just show you something on the screen. Windows 10, you know, under boot camp anyway, does not behave that way. I actually looked at Microsoft support articles for, like, hey, what do? If you've got Windows 10 and you turn it on and you get a black screen. And there's a bunch of solutions for, you know, here's how you turn on safe mode booting, yada, yada. They all require you to be able to see something on the screen. If you just have a black screen, their solution is, it's a very scary support document. It's like, hold down the power button for 10 seconds and then until your machine reboots. And then as soon as you see anything on the screen, hold down the power button again for 10 seconds and then your machine reboots. And then as soon as you see anything, like it makes you like forcibly turn the thing off like 3 times in a row. And then supposedly a real Windows computer would be like, oh, I see you want to be in Windows recovery mode. And then you have a bunch of options. But despite me doing this very abusive thing to my computer, it never went into Windows recovery mode. Like I was holding down the power button as soon as I saw the Windows 10 logo appear. All it did was make it angry. It never actually put me into WinRE or Windows recovery environment, whatever the hell it is. So that didn't work for me. So then I had to use the good old fallback, which is connect a crappier monitor through a different interface. So I connected my 4K monitor through HDMI. Lo and behold, that worked. Then I downloaded AMD's new bootcamp drivers for my newly installed GPU, which again, I'm kind of surprised Windows didn't like find for me or didn't fall back to some default graphics driver. Like just get me to the point where I can launch a web browser and do it myself. But no, that didn't work. So I installed the new drivers, which is nice that AMD had on their site. Hey, here's the new drivers for, the newly released 5700X, W5700X that you have in your computer, and it's specially designed for bootcamp, yada, yada. So that solved that problem. So now I could boot into Windows. And why was I booting into Windows? So I could play games. And of course, what game do I care about? I want to play Destiny. I played Destiny, through Steam that I already had installed and everything. And the answer to the question of whether it can run Destiny 2 at full 6K resolution with all settings on high at 60 frames per second with this card is no, it cannot. That is above the capabilities of this card. It's okay. You get like 30-ish frames per second or whatever. So I was kind of sad to not be able to do that. This is, the best MPX module that I can get for less than $2,000, and it still can't quite hit 60 with the highest settings.
Now, how does that compare? Like, I don't follow the PC GPU market that well. Like, suppose you had a 2080, 1080. What's the big NVIDIA card?
That could definitely do it.
Okay, so what are those? What does one of those cost? Like $400?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. All right. So,
or maybe 600 if you get a fancy one. I don't know.
Okay. So basically what you're saying is that this $1,000, workstation-ish card for the Mac Pro cannot achieve gaming performance that a $400 gaming card could.
Yeah, although I don't think that gaming card could drive the Pro Display XDR native res, period, because the only interface to the Pro Display XDR is Thunderbolt 3, and they don't have Thunderbolt 3 out, so that's always the problem. Like, that's why I'm in this situation, is I want to drive this big fancy screen. So anyway, I turned it down to 4K, which is perfectly fine for Destiny. Like, honestly, the assets in the game probably don't stand up to much more than 4K. So I turned it down to 4K, and then I turned all the settings to max except for a few of them. So it's like a hybrid of the max setting, and I turned to like the foliage draw distances on high instead of highest or whatever. And that's locked at 60 frames per second. So,
oh, that's pretty close.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really close. It's just like, what it is like with PC games, the super duper ultra settings, no one should ever run them because you cannot really discern any visual distance between the super ultra settings and the merely high settings. So I have everything on high with half the settings on highest at 4K in HDR, and it looks and plays great. Like, especially the HDR with all the, Destiny's got all sorts of lighting effects for explosions and space magic and all sorts of stuff like that. It looks amazing. Like, it's really very impressive, because I haven't really done HDR gaming before. So it's very impressive, very sharp, very fast. And the first Crucible match I played, I ended up randomly landing on a team with MTashed, who is a semi-famous Destiny YouTuber / streamer. And we both had crap games, and that was exciting. He only got 3 more kills than me, and our team lost. I did much worse than he did, but seriously, he should be getting way more than 3 more kills than me in a match. That's my video card stuff. So far, so good. I'll continue to investigate the weirdness, see if I can actually get the 580X to run my screen if I wanted to, because that's the other thing I was thinking about. Is like, well, if I'm not playing games or I'm not using something GPU intensive, remember the 580X doesn't have display stream compression, and the fancy new video card does, which means that my USB ports in the back of my monitor are now faster. They're now USB 3 with the new video card, with the USB 2 with the old one. So far, so good. For the most part, I'm happy with it. I'm still debating my options, but I had some good fun in Destiny. Oh, and I re-signed up to Apple Arcade just so I could play through Sayonara Wild Hearts at 6K, and that was really nice.
How is Apple Arcade? Are we following that at all? Like, is there anything good on there that, like, since launch?
I've never played it.
Most of the games, like, if you look through the games, there are no bad games. All the games are like, this is a good quality implementation of this type of game. The question is, are you into that kind of game? And there's a wide variety of games. They're not, you know, yes, as your usual like racing games and platforming games, but there's lots of very interesting games. I think that it's a bargain. Like for $5 a month, you get access to a pretty big collection of games that are mostly pretty good. And remember, none of them have in-app purchases or anything like that. I think it's a great deal, but it depends. You have to know what kind of gaming lifestyle you are leading. I am at this point mostly in a monogamous gaming lifestyle where I'm just playing Destiny. And I'm just waiting for, Last of Us Part 2 and a few other sort of flagship once every year and a half type games that I will divert myself into. But if that's the type of gamer you are, maybe Apple Arcade doesn't make sense for you. But if you graze, or if you're just like, I'm just in the mood to see what a game is. Like I just did today. Hey, I wanted to try some games on my new fancy GPU on my Mac. Where do you find Mac games? Basically nowhere. Or Apple Arcade. And I went to Apple Arcade, and guess what? There's a ton of Mac games because Apple Arcade forces these people to make their games run on the Mac. And the games are all pretty good. Like it is a lot like the consoles, where Apple has a hand in selecting and managing the games that appear on the platform. And I've played, maybe 10, 12 Apple Arcade games, when it launched. And today I just had the urge to play one again. I ended up going to Sayonara Wild Hearts just because I hadn't played it in ages and I really loved that game. $5. And now it wasn't $5 for me to play that one game. I have access to the entire library until the end of the month again. So I think it's a good deal if you are the type of person who doesn't just play one or two games all the time. It seems that a lot of people in our circles have been falling more into the, if not monogamous, then, sort of serial monogamous type of strategy where it's like, oh, everyone's playing Animal Crossing, or, the Armit family is playing Minecraft, or like, rather than sort of dedicating a week or two to one game and then a week or two to another game, something like that, which I think is more of a thing that you do when you were a kid, because you basically burn through a game in a week or two or finish it. Whereas now I think most adults are looking for like a lifestyle game where if you have any gaming time, exactly where you're going to spend it and you have some fun and then you set it aside and you come back to it.
The thing that has me concerned about Apple Arcade is that everyone has basically said that exact same thing about it. Oh yeah, the games are nice. They're, good games. But I'm not hearing about many specific games. In fact, I haven't heard of a single specific game after the launch that everyone says, like, oh, you got to play this one game.
Well, that's because most of the people are playing some single game. You certainly heard a lot about Animal Crossing, right? Lots of people are just playing Animal Crossing. They're not playing anything else, right? Sayonara Wild Hearts, by its nature, is a short game where it's not like an ongoing type of thing. It just is a certain number of levels, and you play them, and you're done with it. So you heard about that at launch, but now everyone has played it. I think a lot of the games in there are like that. You can play them and finish them. And once you've played them and finished them, you're done. The key value proposition for Apple Arcade is you don't buy a bunch of individual games. You pay $5 and get access to all of them. So your value for that $5, if you finish one game, you've got your $5 worth for the month, right? If you try 12 other games, you've gotten way more than your $5 worth, right? So you just have to know, is that a thing that you're ever going to do? Or are you just going to play one game? I just paid $5 just to have a single playthrough, an album, whatever it's called, the album mode, or the mode where it just plays straight through without pauses between levels. That's worth $5 to me right there. I pay similar amount to rent movies from iTunes and play them for the same amount of, and watch it for the same amount of time I just played this. I just got to remember to cancel because I'm probably not going to play any of those games because I'll be too busy playing Destiny.
I will say we finally started watching The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus. This is the first Apple TV Plus show that I've actually watched, and it's pretty good. I'm actually enjoying it.
You should try For All Mankind after that.
Yep, agreed.
Yeah, that's probably next on the list. But yeah, it's here I am, like, coming very late to everything. I finally watched Apple TV Plus. And yeah, it's not bad.
I just started watching Defending Jacob, which is notable because it is ostensibly shot in and around where I live. And it's fun to watch as a resident to say, that's not, I don't know where they're actually shooting it, but like, that's not where I live. Lots of fake signs, lots of made up names. It's kind of a depressing show about murder and school-age children, or anyway, so maybe not your cup of tea, but I started watching that just for the hometown aspect of it, and because I remember when a bunch of roads around me were closed down for filming. I had heard that the stars of the show is Chris Evans and Kerry Russell, maybe? Anyway, Captain America. Yeah, I had heard that he wasn't going to be here. So don't bother coming to the set because Chris Evans isn't going to be here. They're just shooting some other scenes or whatever, which is either it's a lie or they composited him in. Because I saw some scenes shot. I'm like, I know where that is. And there's Chris Evans standing there. I could have gone by and waved to him, but I didn't. That was a while ago. But again, it could have been green screen. It's really hard for me to tell. I got to have Todd look at it and tell me, is Chris Evans actually there? They just put him in.
Yeah, I thought Morning Show was good. I thought For All Mankind was even better. And those are the only two I've tried, but I enjoyed them both.
I watched C, which is a little bit silly, but if you like that kind of thing, it's fine.
Let's keep ourselves in Mac Pro Corner. Do you want to tell me about your wheels and feet and heights and angles and things?
Yeah, this strategy of putting wheels on the front and feet on the back or vice versa so that you have something that you can wheel but that doesn't go anywhere until you pick up the feety part. Jeremy Cox did some measurements based on stuff on the product pages. And apparently the wheels are about an inch taller than the feet. So if you were to do that, you'd have roughly a 4-degree slope. But more importantly, it would look and feel awful because the feet on the Mac Pro are totally flat. So they'd be like on an angle just touching at the edge. So yeah, you'd have to make an adjustment. You need basically 1-inch heels on your feet to get a level Mac Pro.
Yeah, I love the illustration that they provided, too. I'll have to make that the chapter art or something, because it's really cool to see, like, oh, yeah, that would be way too much, like way too big of a slope.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. All right, so we have some feedback about the iPad Magic Keyboard. Matt Berkler writes that they just tried it out again, was actually impressed how hard they could bang on the space bar, and provided a video. And apparently this thing is like very precariously perched with only the iPad portion on a table, and the entire keyboard is dangling in thin air, but because of physics and counterlevers and whatnot, it's somehow, and I guess all the weight is in the back, so it's somehow staying afloat. But this is stressing me out just watching this.
It's, I think the video, you know, be impressed, like, wow, how stable. But all this is doing is emphasizing exactly how lopsided the weight distribution on this thing is. Like, it is so heavily back weighted, again, which is why they can't tilt the thing back any farther. All of the weight starts basically where the keyboard ends. And that's why you can get away with what's shown in this video. You should definitely watch it to realize exactly how, you know, back weighted it is. It's not tippy. It's not going to tip over backwards, but all of the weight is on that end, which is, you know, don't try this with your laptop because you will have very different results and be very sad very quickly. And yeah, so this is, if it's not clear, this is not the weight distribution that you want for a laptop. You would rather have the weight low and flat to the ground, like in a car or like in Marco's car. All the big heavy battery is at the bottom, low and wide, right? You don't, if Marco's battery was on the roof of his car, it would be like this keyboard stand.
All right, John, not Syracuse, writes in that alternators, guess what? They do generate alternating current. They're used in cars because they're smaller and more efficient, thank you to Tesla, as in Nikola Tesla. And a simple rectifier circuit converts AC to DC for the battery, etc. A DC generator would be larger, heavier, and less efficient at low RPMs. And then Craig Weber also adds, a generator produces DC directly through what's effectively a mechanical bridge rectifier, but less efficiently.
Yeah, so cars, all the stuff inside your car is running on DC, but your alternator is making AC briefly before it's converted.
Indeed. And then King T-Bird writes, always ground to the alternator bracket or a similar point on the engine, as that will bypass the battery. This is in the context of jumping a car to the same ground the starter uses. Trust me, it makes a huge difference in the current delivered without passing through a dead battery, especially a shot battery.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about, like, if your battery's totally fried. Obviously, mine wasn't totally fried. I was able to start it by going through the battery. But again, today I actually replaced the battery. I looked for, I still didn't go to the point where I looked in the owner's manual. I still didn't go that far. But while I had the engine bay open, I'm like, is there some post where it wants me to ground in here? Is there something? I could see a couple of nuts that in theory could be used for it, but nothing labeled as like a grounding spot. And practically speaking, my two little clampy thingies, if the positive one is on the positive, the negative one doesn't reach very far. It's not like I can go across to the other corner of the engine and find something to clamp onto. So if there's some post for me to put it, I still couldn't find it. And by the way, when I did the replacing my battery today, this is the first time I've ever successfully done this thing that I always think about doing. I don't even know if this is true of modern cars, but I used to be annoyed with my older cars that when I replaced the battery, the car would like forget all its settings, right? Because there's no NVRAM essentially. And all your radio presets would be gone and all your preferences and settings and everything would just be gone. And that annoyed me because I'm like, I don't remember when I set this thing up, you know, 6 years ago, right? So this time I said, I'm not going to let that happen. I don't know for a fact whether my car has NVRAM. I'm hoping it does because it's more modern, but I don't want to take the risk. So I very carefully used my battery charger and clamped it onto the little thingies and then disconnected them from the battery.
Oh, my goodness.
Keeping current flowing through the car while I swapped out the battery. Then I put in the new battery and very carefully put the little things over and screwed them on and then disconnected it. And as far as I can tell, everything worked and I didn't lose any info and I have a shiny new battery. Oh, and speaking of my battery, it came with a little round sticker on it that says 3/20 on the top. And I don't know what that is supposed to be. It's probably March 2020, right? Maybe it's a sticker that says, like, that's when this battery was manufactured or something. I don't know what the purpose of the sticker is supposed to be. But the reason I noticed the sticker at all is because it was like a reddish sticker. But there was a little crescent moon of a green sticker poking out from underneath it. So I peeled off the red sticker. And underneath the red sticker was a green sticker that said 1/20. I just put the 320 sticker next to it. So now my battery has two stickers on it. At least the thing underneath didn't say like 4/17. So pretty sure my battery's fine. Car starts right up. Battery's fully charged. Everything's great. Go team.
All right. We didn't get a chance to talk about this last week, but Apple has released exposure notification in, what is this? iOS 13.5, something like that, whatever came out today.
Yep, 13.5 beta.
And so there's some stuff in settings that will allow you to turn on or off COVID-19 exposure notifications. And that is the thing where the iPhone will, in the background, it will communicate via Bluetooth Low Energy and kind of, if I understand things right, kind of say, I'm here and I am code 1234, and I'm oversimplifying here. And then it will listen to other phones saying, I'm here and I'm code 5678. And it will keep a kind of database or tally of who it's seen for, you know, a certain duration of time, so that if a central health authority finds out that 5678 has coronavirus, you can look up all the people who have been tested positive and compare who you've seen with who is tested positive and say, I was around them at some point. I should probably self-isolate, quarantine, and then maybe even get tested. This, at a glance, seems pretty solid. I'm pleased with what I've seen. To be fair, I haven't looked into this deeply. It seems like in order to write an app that leverages this API, you need a certain
entitlement. Yeah.
Thank you. Yep. You need a certain entitlement, which presumably Apple will not be giving out willy-nilly. But I don't know. At a glance, this looks pretty good. Marco, thoughts about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, contact tracing or, you know, exposure notification is a pretty important part of controlling a pandemic and dealing with it. And so, you know, the need for this is very high. The fact that Apple and Google worked together to develop a standard that both Google-powered Android phones and all of the iPhones could both use and talk to each other is really remarkable. And so, like, just that alone, the fact that they worked together pretty quickly and developed this thing that they could both, you know, swallow and were willing to do for all the people out there who have either platform, that's really impressive. And if you look at the actual, you know, design of the system, obviously you would think, all right, well, if the phones are going to be like passively trading identifiers with each other all the time, and then they'll keep some kind of history of what other identifiers they've seen, and then they'll be able to, like, you know, notify, oh, I've seen identifiers 10, 15, and 20, so notify them because I now have the virus. They need to know that that they were exposed to me. You would think this would be a privacy nightmare. But the way they've designed the system is both simple and pretty clever to basically use a bunch of, like, short-lived random tokens. And they're all, like, you know, stored locally on device. There's, you know, there's no real persistence, no persistent identifiers, no real tracking possible beyond a 15-minute window of any one particular identifier. So it's actually, like, if you look at the system, I can't see any problems with the system as designed, at least any big problems, like any kind of massive privacy violation or you know, creepy tracking potential. Like, they've done a really good job. I suspect, like, oftentimes what happens with standard bodies or you know, tech standards is Apple basically designs the whole thing and then hands it to the other party and is like, this is now our standard. That happens a lot from what I hear. And you know, like things like USB-C. So apparently, you know, Apple frequently does stuff like that. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's what happened here, because this is a very Apple-y kind of system. And I can't imagine Google coming up with the system, you know, if they were, you know, at the drawing board. So ultimately, it looks very good. It isn't, you know, out to the public yet. And there are a bunch of complicated questions of things like, should it be enabled by default? Like, should your phone be broadcasting these identifiers by default? And there's certainly a slight privacy angle to that. But I think the system is so well designed that I would argue that, yes, it should be on by default, because the privacy implication is so tiny. Like, the scope of potential privacy risks is so small and so minor. And if it's not on by default for everyone, it's far less effective. You might as well not even do it if it isn't on by default. So I'm hoping they end up with that. I think that is the plan right now. Maybe there is some kind of one of those, like, you know, setup wizard screens when you first boot up, you know, 13.5, that it might, you know, it might ask you and just be defaulted to yes. But hopefully it is, you know, totally, you know, up and up and, you know, on by default and everything else. And hopefully the same applies to the Android platform as well. There is certainly the question of, like, how the heck Android phones are getting a large-scale software update in any kind of reasonable amount of time. I assume, I don't know anything about this, but I assume that this is part of the Google Play Services thing, where, like, Google kind of has this library of stuff they can update on a much more frequent basis compared to the actual OS of all these phones that never get updated. So it's most likely there. So yeah, hopefully the system can get deployed soon and enabled by default on a lot of different phones, because that would really be quite effective at achieving this. There's all sorts of problems that they have clearly considered or been made aware of and addressed in some way. Like, for instance, you wouldn't want to be able to just spam everybody by saying, like, I got the virus, even if you didn't, and be able to spam all the people who were near you for the last week or whatever, and have, you know, scare them all, or have them all go to get tested unnecessarily or whatever. So, like, they've thought about stuff like, okay, only public health authorities will be able to notify or to be able to submit the thing that says this person has it for sure, stuff like that. So, like, there's all sorts of concerns that they've been seemingly addressing pretty well. Some countries, there was this whole drama with, like, certain countries, I think France was one of them, and where, like, they didn't want this kind of approach that was totally passive. They wanted, like, only an app that the user would be launching and keeping in the foreground and keeping their phone on with the screen on all the time for it to work. And it's like, that's not going to do anything. That's a no-go. I think most of those countries seem to be coming around that this is actually the better way to do it. So anyway, from what I can see so far, it looks really good. If you want to hear more detail about how it works or read more detail about how it works, there's a good article on NS Hipster about basically the whole API, how, you know, what it does, how it works, why it's important, why it's pretty safe, like, privacy-wise. So we'll link to that from the show notes. And otherwise, I think it's a great thing that they're doing. I hope it gets deployed widely and quickly.
Like a lot of the... when we talk about security and other non-virus-related contexts, we're always talking about the classic trade-off between convenience and security. Lots of stuff that has to do with security is inconvenient. You just want to get to the thing. You don't want to have to say okay to a bunch of permission dialog boxes. You don't have to enter a bunch of passwords. You don't want your password to have to be long and complicated. Basically, security and convenience are opposing forces, and you have to trade one for the other. And that's a difficult trade-off, because we all just want convenience. We also want the security, but day-to-day, we just want the convenience. For the virus stuff, that kind of same trade-off still exists. You know, Marco was just talking about, you know, having to leave an app turned on and everything like that, which would be quote-unquote more secure because you'd be aware that you're doing it, but it's ridiculously inconvenient, right? But the real trade-off here is efficacy versus security, right? The more the system respects your privacy, the less effective it is, right? So you can imagine a system that totally violated your privacy that would be way more effective. To give just one example, nowhere in this scheme that Apple has come up with is location information used anywhere, period. Like, The random identifiers that are sprayed out, they're just random identifiers. Nobody knows where anybody is. There is no location information recorded or exchanged whatsoever. All it knows is that you saw this other device that sprayed this number out. It doesn't know where you are when you saw it. I don't even know if it knows the time of day when you saw it. It's just merely like exposure. Have you been exposed? Did you get this number sprayed at you from this number, this, you know, so on and so forth, right? The fact that only, you know, that it's voluntary and that you have to go through this whole big procedure to submit the fact that to assert the say, you know, I've got it. I've been diagnosed. They tested me. I'm positive. The process of doing that, A, it's voluntary. You don't have to do it if you don't want to, because again, that's better for privacy, right? If it was involuntary and if you tested positive, you had no choice and they would submit your thing. Worse for privacy, better for effectiveness, because at this point, someone would be like, oh, I don't want to submit that, right? And then you have to go through some process, which you have to know about and the doctor has to know about, and you have to come together and do all that stuff. If instead, this is one of the things the other countries talk about, let's say that it sprayed out your location and a bunch of identifiers and times of days, and it was all collected into one global server somewhere so that some central authority or government had tracking information in real time of every single person and where they are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and what other things are in the vicinity. And it connected up involuntarily to all their private health information. So as soon as someone tested positive, no participation needed. We would just connect all the dots and find all the people. That would be way more effective and a privacy nightmare. So we're talking about, oh, convenience, privacy trade-off, and you can have debates about it or whatever. This is a whole different ballgame, because it's a similar set of trade-offs, but on the other side is like public health, right? You're inconvenienced. No matter how inconvenienced you are, you probably don't die. You know, or someone you know probably doesn't die, which is part of the reason these countries with, I think, better governments, with citizenry that has more faith in its government, were pushing the system. I said, well, why won't you just let us report all this information centrally to the government automatically? Because that's the purpose of government, to do a thing that individuals can't do. The collective, as elected by the people, responsibility is to, you know, serve the public good. And it is entrusted to serve the public good through the system of government that we have, right? So why wouldn't we want to collect it? And Apple and Google are like, no, we're not going to do that. Our system is completely anonymous. You can't track people. There's no location. And there's no central, you know, authority or whatever. It's on-device information. It's, you know, like all those privacy-preserving things make it less effective, but protects against what we know would happen in the United States, which is that some giant corporation would eventually get this information, or they would leak out of the government, or, you know, would end up on a bunch of servers and on the dark web or whatever. Like, inevitably, it would get out. Like, you know, we can't even keep our credit information secure. Like, there is no way to have that valuable pile of information in the United States and not have it get out to bad actors, let alone before you consider whether the government itself is a bad actor and stuff like that. So it's, you know, Apple and Google are doing what they can within the parameters that present themselves. But, you know, and the final bit is that this isn't even out yet. We're talking about iOS 13.5 beta. 13.5 presumably will be out in the next week or two. But there is a question of, by the time this actually gets out, and by the time actually people update their phones, you know, how much value can it deliver? And how much is that value necessarily constrained by, you know, the dire environment in the United States and in general across the world? Like, to have to sort of code for the worst case scenario and say, we have to be very aggressive about protecting your privacy, even though we know it will make this effort less effective than it could be. And I think they've probably made the right trade-off, because it is not an ideological trade-off. It is the trade-offs they've made recognize the realities of the world. But I feel bad for the countries that are essentially doing better than us and have more faith in their government, because we can't afford to have a system like this that works well in the best of cases, but is a disaster in the worst of cases, because so many places in the world, including the US, are the worst of cases.
Yay.
I mean, assuming if it's not on by default, are you two going to turn it on?
Oh, totally.
I mean, well, I don't see any downside to it personally. Like, more data is good. I don't particularly want to, I don't want to know if I've been potentially infected, but I really want to know if I've been potentially infected. So, yeah, I would absolutely turn it on. I'm not currently in a position where I think it's worth running the beta, especially since it doesn't appear that there's any like health organizations that have released an app for it, as far as I know. But no, I definitely will turn it on once the opportunity arises, when 13.5 is out for real.
The other thing about this is whenever there's any technology involved in health, there's the danger of the magic thinking of technology, especially people who aren't into technology. I think it's whatever that saying of like, if you're actually a programmer, you know that all software is horrible, but if you're not, you might think it's magic. So part of what this system has to do is decide what counts as exposure, right? It's not just, oh, I received a communication via Bluetooth of this identifier, because that could happen when you drive by somebody in a car, right? You probably didn't get it from them. They have to decide, how long do you have to be within proximity of this thing to count as an exposure? Because practically speaking, again, if you walk past each other on opposite sides of the street on opposite sidewalks, you're probably not going to get affected. Mostly from what we know of the transmissibility, you're probably okay on opposite sides of the street. But if you hang out in an elevator for half an hour, you're probably going to get it, right? So somewhere between there, this system has to decide what counts as exposure. But because it's technology, they're going to be like, oh, well, I got an exposure notification. That means I was exposed. Well, maybe. Or maybe they, were a little bit conservative with the exposure, and really they made it like a 2-second gap, and really you walked past someone at a 12-foot distance and were within range for them for 2 seconds and it counted as an exposure. Or if you don't get a notification, you're like, yay, I wasn't exposed. Maybe. Or maybe they set it so you had to be in close proximity for somebody for 5 minutes and you were in proximity for 4 minutes and 30 seconds and you got it, but you didn't get the notification. So keep in mind that, even when working as designed, this is a necessarily an imperfect system. All we're trying to do is help. This is better than not having the system, but it is not, like anything else we're going to hear, a complete solution to the problem. If you get notified this, it doesn't mean you're sure you have it. If you don't get notified, it doesn't mean you're sure you're not. It just adds more information than you had before.
I would also say, like, for all of you listeners out there, this is a thing where, like, the question of whether you enable it shouldn't even be a question. Yes, enable it. Like, this is, if you actually look at what it does and how it works, it's a no-brainer. Like, there should be no controversy about it. There should be no real concern about what it's doing. Like, it will only work if everybody enables it. So just enable it. Like, research, if you're concerned, research what it actually does, and you'll see, you'll see, as I have by looking into like the actual protocol, what it's actually doing, that it's fine. Like, this is one of those cases like vaccines where like the only people who are going to be afraid of it and not do it are people who have less information, willfully or not. Like, if you actually look at what it's doing, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, and of course it's software. There can be bugs and so on and so forth. But like in the grand scheme of things, your phone company already has so much more information about you than you can ever possibly imagine. enable this. It's a no-brainer. If you're listening to this thing to get advice from people who know stuff about technology, or we're telling you because of what I just mentioned, how incredibly limited this is and how preserving it is of your privacy. That's the reason why you should just do it by default. It's a no-brainer.
Also in 13.5, there are group FaceTime and Face ID improvements. I haven't had the time to look into this myself, but my limited understanding is you can, or I guess when it detects that you're wearing a mask, it will not wait near as long trying to figure out whether or not this is your face, and it will just immediately show you a password prompt. Did I get that right?
It'll scan your face. Like, it's still doing the face scanning. But rather than just saying, I'm trying to recognize his face, it will take a break if it doesn't immediately recognize your face and say, okay, I didn't recognize the face, but does this look like a face that's wearing a mask? And I'm not sure how it does that. It could do it with a depth sensor, looking for like basically a person without a nose and a mouth, or it could do it with the camera, looking for a big region that doesn't look like a face, or, who knows, could be some machine learning. Well, anyway, there's some magic that basically says, if I don't recognize a face, the next thing I'm going to do is try to recognize a mask. And if I recognize a mask, then I'm going to fall back to passcode rather than keep trying to recognize the face, which is a smart thing to do and some, fast work from Apple.
Yeah, like in the Face ID training thing, when you're registering your face with it, it has a thing. If you tried to do the second appearance as one with a mask, which I've tried and many people have, it doesn't work for most people, it seems. It certainly didn't work for me. But what it does is if you're wearing a mask or a half folded over mask or whatever trick people tell you might work, the Face ID registration thing says your face is obstructed. Like, it actually has that as a status it can detect and show you. It's probably using that exact same logic to see, like, all right, is your face, does this look like a face, but one that is obstructed? Yes, then immediately fail and go to the passcode screen. Which, you know, Face ID is the way all modern iPhones authenticate, you know, with the exception of the very, very, you know, old slash new SE and previous models, but like, all those aren't, I wouldn't call those like modern iPhones. Like, all the modern iPhones use Face ID as their only biometric authentication method. This is not going to be a great long-term solution, and we're going to be wearing masks for a while. You know, some countries are going to keep wearing them as they have been for, you know, lots of conditions, if not all the time. Some professions require their workers to wear masks all day, every day, or much of the day. And I don't think the mask thing is going to go away in the next few months. So I think this is a good stopgap to make the current situation a little less crappy. But this is only a temporary solution, I think. So it's great Apple's buying some time. I hope the real solution ends up being either a new line of phones that has Touch ID and Face ID somehow and will let you have some kind of setting that says, like, all right, whichever way you recognize me first, just trust that and go. And or have a setting on Face ID that makes it less secure, that basically doesn't check for your mouth and just, all right, recognize me by like my eyes and my forehead. And yeah, that's less data points and it's going to be less secure, but I'll take that trade-off. Because right now the alternative is, like, I've been using an alphanumeric passcode forever, and I just had to switch to a number passcode this past couple of weeks because every time I have to go shopping with a mask on and everything, I can't use my phone very easily. And typing in a alphanumeric passcode sucks when you're wearing gloves, potentially. And it's certainly inconvenient to like have to do that every time you're checking your shopping list in the grocery store. Ideally, Apple has to find some way to make their biometric authentication on the iPhone work when people are wearing face masks. That is the only good long-term solution here. So whether it's re-adding Touch ID and having it be simultaneous recognition, or whether it's giving an option to have Face ID have probably less security but have it operate with a mask on, that's the real long-term solution here. We don't have that yet, but I hope they're working on it.
The lead times on getting a Touch ID back into the phone are too long for them to do it as a reaction to the virus, because it either been in their roadmap for years or it hasn't been. We're all hoping that, you know, right, for years that they were going to bring it back as underscreen, and I've always been saying underscreen, either whole or half screen Touch ID, where you don't even have to have your finger in a specific spot. But there was no rush for it when we were talking about that. It was like, oh, that would be a cool thing to have. In the meantime, Face ID is fine. But now there's a little bit more urgency. But, you know, if that's... The reason they haven't been doing that is, you know, one, cost, and two, my understanding is that the underscreen ones are still not as good as the dedicated one that Apple has on the SE in terms of how secure it is, how many points can it pick up, how easy it is to read your finger, yada, yada, right? So maybe 3 or 4 years from now, Touch ID will, you know, if they start now, 3 or 4 years from now, Touch ID could make its triumphant return underneath our screens of our iPhone 27s or whatever the hell. I guess... 11 plus 3 or 4 is not 27, but do your own math. You know, with Apple's naming, you know what? I take it back. There's no reason it couldn't be 27 with Apple's naming screen. But yeah, in the meantime, other solutions like Margo suggested are much easier to do quickly. Weakening Face ID by only doing your eyeballs or your forehead, maybe a little bit too weak. The one that sprung to mind immediately to me, and it would help Apple sell more stuff, is have better linked unlock with your Apple Watch, kind of like they do with macOS, right? Because the watch doesn't suffer this because it's always touching your screen. So it can be used as a proxy key to say, as long as you don't take your watch off and as long as your watch is unlocked, if you pick up your phone and try to open it and it's close by your watch, then your phone will unlock automatically too. Given how well that works or doesn't on the Mac, maybe they need to work on that feature a little bit. But I would think that that would be more secure than eyeball Face ID. I suppose they could do retina scans, but again, that's another 5 to 10 year timeline for them to come up with that amazing technology.
Additionally, the group FaceTime in 13.5 beta, you can optionally turn off the enlarging of whoever's speaking. Now, I'm familiar with this in principle, but I have not experienced this myself. And to be honest, almost any group call I've been on has been Zoom, not FaceTime. But my understanding is, especially once you get like 3 or 4 people involved with a single FaceTime call, is that this gets real annoying real fast. So now there's a switch. This is where you can disable the enlarge the face of the speaker feature.
Yeah, I mean, this is true, like, on Zoom calls as well. Zoom has this wonderful option called Grid View, and I'm not a video chat expert. I don't know how many other platforms have this, but, you know, the idea of if you have a conference call or video call with, you know, more than a handful of people, you know, normally what these platforms would try to do is may have, like, one big rectangle for, like, the primary person and then a bunch of smaller rectangles for, like, everyone else, and then basically detect and switch whoever was talking the loudest at any given time. They would be shown as the big primary square, and then when somebody else was talking, it would switch to them. And turns out this is kind of annoying a lot of the times. And having just a basic grid view where everyone is the same size, and just no matter what, when people are talking, like, the arrangement stays stable, that is a lot better in a lot of conditions. And so this is basically saying that that will now become a possibility for the FaceTime video chat, I think, right? Am I interpreting this correctly, that that's what this means?
I don't know if that's, like, I think we're all correct on, like, the thing they're reacting against, which is the current implementation, which I have used. And it's the current implementation is trying to be an app-less version of what Margo just described as the default for Zoom or, you know, lots of other things where there's one, the whole screen gets taken by whoever's talking, and then there's a smaller version of other people. That's what Face ID does now, except for instead of having it be, like, big and everything else, it gradually moves between those phases. So it's just a bunch of floating boxes. And as you start to be the dominant talker, your box gets bigger and bigger, but never quite as big as full screen. But then if someone else goes, you get smaller and that other box gets bigger. So it's trying to be a smooth, dynamic version of the very binary. You either get the whole screen or you're one of the background bit players, right? What I don't know is there... All right, so what is the fix for that? Is the fix for that just a grid? Maybe. I haven't seen any screenshots to know whether it is. The fix for that could also be just a bunch of little floating boxes, but they don't get any bigger. But, I think a much more Apple-ish solution to this, and one that actually would be used by people who find themselves in the situation. I know because I've done lots of family group FaceTimes. You just direct manipulation, right? People know what they want to see at any given moment. Now, it's annoying to have to manipulate it manually, but for example, very often someone is showing something. Look, some kid is holding up a picture they drew. That's what you want to see. But at the same time, someone else is talking, saying, oh, that's so nice. When did you draw that? What is that supposed to be? Or what, you know, like the one talking is not the one you want to see. So you need the person who's using the interface to be able to say, I know what I want to see. I want to see the picture, and have them do what everybody knows how to do with their phone, which is pinch to zoom. Just grab the picture, grab the thing you want to see, make it come to the front, pinch to zoom, chuck it into the corner, like direct manipulation. And to go along with the direct manipulation, you need to turn off the sort of, you know, non-direct manipulation, the sort of, I didn't touch anything, but things are moving around and changing anyway, right? So if you just start with a grid view and let people sort of zoom and shrink as needed, I think that'll cover basically every use case without having any sort of machine learning, artificial intelligence, noise canceling, whatever, whatever. And it's better than grid view because in grid view, the more people you get, the smaller everybody becomes. So if you get 12 people on a call and you want to see little Susie's picture that she drew, it's too damn small. And then if your only option is zoom Susie to full screen or make Susie a thumbnail, then you're back to the zoom thing, which is, you know, it's passable. You can either be full screen, you can choose what you want to be full screen, or you can be one of the little tiny ones. But sometimes you want something that's kind of in between. So I really hope Apple just lets us directly manipulate those little floating people. And then, you know, if there's any auto manipulation at all, have it to be very gentle and have some way to sort of reset back to a reasonable grid type mode. But yeah, I don't like the floating and the zooming and the changing. I find it very annoying. I find it hard to keep track of things, and people keep moving around. And yeah, I'm not a fan. And the other thing that I'm not a fan of is trying to set up a group FaceTime call, even if everybody in your family has Apple devices, is way more of a pain than it needs to be due to, like, the way of Apple's various messaging applications in general are not good about letting you sort of select how you want to contact somebody. Like, we have, you know, contact entries in our address book or whatever, and everybody has 5 email addresses, and one of them is an Apple ID, but this person's Apple ID is also their Hotmail address, but this person's Apple ID is their Gmail address, but this person has a Gmail address, but that's not their Apple ID. And, like, you know, when you want to contact somebody in the FaceTime app, very often you have to, like, be very careful to say, okay, when you bring this person in, don't use their Gmail address, but this person, use their Hotmail address, but don't use their phone number for this person because they're not on their phone device, they're on their iPad, and the phone number isn't, it's just like, oh my God, figure it out. Like, I'm in FaceTime and I want to do a FaceTime. Like, whatever it's going to take to do a FaceTime, do that. And I just want to pick the contact. I don't want to have to know which person I should pick a phone number for and which person I should pick an email for and which person I should pick their Apple ID for. And very often what will happen is you'll do it and like, oh, that my phone is ringing, but it's not on my iPad. But I don't want it to be my phone. Can you send it to my iPad? Just setting up the call is half the challenge. It's easier to set up a Microsoft Teams meeting, for crying out loud, because at work, everybody just says one work email, and it's the work's domain, that, and there's no question about who you're connecting to. But with home people, with all the different things, it's annoying. It's the same thing I used to complain about in messages, where messages would be split up, and I wanted them to be grouped by person, but then you're like, well, where, you know, they all have that preference. Like, where do you want your message to first come from? Do you want it to come from your phone number? Do you want it to come from your Apple ID? Do you want your Mac to listen on your phone number? But you can only do that when your phone is in proximity. It's too confusing. Like, too many of the implementation details are exposed. Implementation details that we don't care about. So in a context where Apple has a fighting chance of knowing what we want, you've launched the FaceTime app and you're trying to do a FaceTime, just figure out which way in the giant contact entry for this person will result in a successful FaceTime, and do that. I don't know. I know it's a difficult problem. It's frustrating. And then once you get on there, their heads are all changing sizes and floating all around.
Oh, the struggle is real. And speaking of struggles, Google's perhaps struggling with chips right now, because there's a rumor in Axios that Google is readying its own chips for future Pixels and Chromebooks. So this is following the Apple playbook, as Google's off to do. And they're supposedly working with Samsung to make their own CPUs.
I can't believe it's taken this long. I mean, yeah, we've been saying for years and years and years that Apple has the best chips in their phones. They're the most powerful. They use the least power. Like, they're just, everything about them is amazing, and it's not by a little bit. It's not like, oh, they're 1 or 2% better. They're hugely better than the competitors' phone chips. You would think the competitors would feel some kind of pressure to say, we need to match this. But instead, just for years and years, they've been willing to outsource it to having Qualcomm make their system on a chips for them, and the Qualcomm system on a chips have, you know, taken more power and not been as fast. Like, the one thing Qualcomm has been doing for them is letting the non-Apple phones have like little spec wars. Like, look how many cores we have, and all the sorts of other things that sound good on paper, but in practice, their CPUs use more battery and are slower than Apple. So, like, what the hell's the point of having umpteen cores if the end result is a slower phone that, you know, takes more power to run, right? So finally, it seems like this is the first rumor I've seen, the first sort of substantial rumor I've seen of Google saying, you know what, we should just make our own chips because Qualcomm sucks and they're not doing the job, and we can do what Apple does and make a chip that's just purpose-built for our phones. Because Google has all sorts of, you know, interesting machine learning ideas, and they're building their own hardware, as we talked to Chris Lattner about this, all their TPUs and the other kind of hardware they build for the data centers for machine learning. That's exactly what Apple does in their phones. They put that neural engine in there designed to help speed up the things that they know they want to do. When Apple rolls out FaceTime, they have hardware that's going to help them do FaceTime better. When Apple does portrait mode, they have hardware in their image processor that helps them do that, right? It's a big win to do that, and Google is the other big player in the phone industry, so they should totally make their own chips. So we'll see how they do.
I don't know. I'm not actually that hopeful about it, because, you know, Google's experience so far with hardware has been mostly middling. The Pixel phones recently have been pretty good in camera stuff, kind of a mixed bag and other stuff. Their heart is not in it, clearly. Like, they don't really prioritize hardware. They're never going to be very good at it. Maybe they can do a passable job, but they clearly are not that into it. In the same way that Apple isn't into so much other stuff that they, you know, do a passable job of. Like, you know, like we were talking about earlier, iCloud Drive. Apple is not a great company for that kind of service, for that kind of product. They're going to consistently do kind of a half-assed job. Things like, you know, iWork document sharing, collaborative document editing, any kind of like, you know, competition for Google Apps. Apple's heart is not in that. They do a pretty poor job of that most of the time. Like, they have some kind of passable solution, but it's nothing compared to the company that cares more about it, which in this case is Google. So, you know, going back to this topic, like, Apple cares a whole lot about making really, really good hardware, especially really good mobile phone and mobile computer hardware and chips and everything. They do a really good job of that. Google doesn't want to do that. they're doing it because they're being competitively forced, the same way Apple's being competitively forced to have iWork collaboration features. Like, Apple doesn't want to do any of that. Like, they're doing it kind of reluctantly, and that's how this feels. It feels like Google is doing this, you know, whatever this chip move is, reluctantly, because they don't really have any other choice competitively for this really important market. But I don't think they're going to do great things.
I think you might be underselling the Google Pixel phones. From everything I've understood, their cameras are at least as good as iPhone cameras, if not better in certain cases, for stills. For video, from everything I've gathered, the iPhone is still leaps and bounds ahead.
That's because of software, though, not hardware. Like, Google is really good at taking a pedestrian camera sensor and getting really good output out of it just using software enhancements. That's not really like a hardware thing.
My very limited understanding is that the Pixel phones are legitimately good phones, and arguably, up until very recently, the only good Android phones. And I think recently that's not the case. But for a while there, you know, certainly when I was still traditionally employed, all of our Android team would swear by the Pixel phones and say they're the ones that are great, and everything else is kind of garbage. And now I think that that's changed a bit. But I think that the Pixel phones, certainly a couple of years ago, were very, very good, and arguably as good as iPhones, if not in certain cases better. I mean, I think a lot of people preferred still cameras on the Pixel phones. And whether that's software or hardware, I mean, it's still ultimately the experience of these cameras some people thought were better. And I haven't tried an Android phone in a long, long time. But I wouldn't say that their hardware is mediocre or, you know, just bargain. Well, not even bargain basement. But it's not just run-of-the-mill stuff you can grab on a store shelf, so to speak. Some of it is very good, from what I've gathered.
Well, what Google's heart is not in is building phones. Forget about system on a chips. Like, their heart is not in building phones for a variety of reasons. Potentially, it's like, well, if they want to be a platform vendor, kind of like the Microsoft thing, why didn't Microsoft make PCs for a long time? It's like, well, PC makers would be mad at us if we made a PC. Microsoft got over that eventually, but still, Microsoft volumes are low. So, yeah, Google gives you Android for all your Android, billions of Android phones in the room. And hey, we also make phones, but don't worry, we don't sell too many of them, Samsung, so it's not a big deal, right? And why is that the case? Maybe because they don't want to anger their vendors, especially in the beginning. They wanted to get traction and not say they were competing with them. But maybe also, Google just, you know, doesn't have the expertise in manufacturing. They, for a while, they outsourced the construction of their Pixel phones. I don't know if they still outsource all of it, and not just like to Foxconn like Apple does, but Apple is intimately involved with the manufacturing process of all its products, including its phones, with lots of Apple employees and technology and everything going into the manufacturing process. Google, my impression, is way less involved than Apple in the manufacturing of its phones. So if it ever wants to be high volume, high quality, it would have to dedicate itself to the manufacturing of the phone. So I'm not sure if they want to do that or if they're going to do that. But the system on a chip is different. Google is totally into building, you know, silicon chip hardware that has synergy with what it wants to do with software. Again, those TPU things with the machine learning, you know, like Apple's not designing, well, maybe they are, we don't know about it. But as far as we know, Apple's not custom designing its own hardware for the data center down to the CPU. Google is doing that, purpose-built hardware just for its machine learning stuff, because that has synergy with the software stuff that it's doing, and it's not a consumer product, so you can, you know, build it all in. So there is a potential that Google could say, hey, if we build our own system on a chip for our phones, we can make something that fits our needs exactly. And we could continue to be, you know, not super into manufacturing phones and continue to sell only a small number of these Pixel phones to discerning people who want a phone that has the trade-offs that the Pixel phones have. But it'll be good for us because we can build into these system on a chips these certain features that help other Google features. Potentially they could sell the system on a chip to other Android vendors, or the other route they could go, and this is what I was thinking with Google making its own system on a chip, is rather than making a powerhouse competitor to the top line A-series chip that Apple makes, instead make a pretty okay chip that is able to run Android and Google stuff very efficiently with very little power consumption and with very low cost, to allow the creation of a Google phone that is way cheaper than any iPhone could be, slower than an iPhone. Like, kind of like, imagine something that is, you know, I can't say it's like the iPhone SE, because the iPhone SE has the best chip in the market in it, which is a weird thing. But, you know, so, like a phone that is acceptably good, but way undercuts anything that Apple could ever put out. And it's difficult to do that because in the Android market, if you get like a cheaper Qualcomm chip, it's so dog slow. If you don't get the top of the line one, it's so dog slow, and it's probably not great with power. And that's, you know, it's, I can imagine Google making a different set of trade-offs than Apple makes, like having dedicated processors for the few important things that make the Google phone impressive, but otherwise giving a middle-of-the-road chip that uses very little power and has good enough performance to allow it to sell Pixel phones at a way lower price. And that could make it so that Apple, and so they keep saying Apple, so that Google could distribute across the world way more phones than they do now that we would look at and say, it's an okay phone, but suddenly Google becomes a volume distributor because they're able to sell this phone and undercut everybody else. And they still outsource all the manufacturing. And if you look at it, you're not super impressed by the industrial design, and the camera is fine. And, you know, the software on it's good. Like these are things that Google can't do because they're stuck using system on a chips made by other people who have other companies that are A, not as good as Apple at it, and B, make trade-offs that are not the same trade-offs that Google would make if it was designing its own phone. So when I envision a Google system on a chip for a phone, I keep thinking of a good enough cheap phone for way less money rather than a flagship Apple destroying phone. But who knows? In this phone market, I've always kind of been baffled by the way Google does things, from the, you know, from their decisions about the trade-off between being the platform owner and also selling your own phones, right down to exactly how long they've gone dealing with third-party chips that are obviously massively inferior to what Apple's putting out and just sort of like not doing anything about it. So now it sounds like they're doing something about it. So we just got to sit back and see how they do.
And speaking of building your own chips, this flew by in a big way a week or two ago, but the ARM Mac is coming, or so we're told. Mark Gurman says, what do you say, 2021? Apple's going to start shipping three of its own Mac processors based on the A14 in the next iPhone. The first of these will be much faster than the processors in the iPhone. Apple's preparing to release at least one Mac with its own chip next year in 2021. The initiative to develop multiple chips, codenamed Kalamata, suggests the company will transition more of its Mac lineup away from the current supplier, Intel. TSMC is going to be building new Mac chips at 5 nanometers. The first Mac processors will have 8 high-performance cores, codenamed Firestorm, and at least 4 energy-efficient cores, known internally as Ice Storm. Very good. Very good code names. I very much approve of them. Apple is exploring Mac processors with more than 12 cores for further in the future. In some Macs, Apple's designs will double or quadruple the number of cores that Intel provides. The current entry-level MacBook Air has 2 cores, for example. And the Kalamata project has been going on for several years. Surprise, surprise. In 2018, Apple developed a Mac chip based on the iPad Pro's A12X processor for internal testing. That gave the company's engineers confidence they could begin replacing Intel Macs as early as 2020. Like with the iPhone, Apple's Mac processors will include several components, including the CPU and GPU. On the one side, this is very exciting, very interesting, and very cool. On the other side, I'll believe it when it happens.
Well, this, you know, we've been talking about this for ages, but there are a few more details in here. We've got a code name, Kalamata. That's good. So now we can talk about this effort, if that code name is real in some way, rather than just saying Apple's ARM transition. We got core counts, and I think the core counts are, you know, surprising. You would expect that there would be more cores than Intel, just because if we look at how many cores are in our phones today, it would be a surprising number for a fanless Mac that fits in your hand, right? Again, with the MacBook Air having only 2 cores, and our phones have, what do they have? They have like the 2 high performance one and the 4 slow ones. I forget what the current phone has.
I know what you're saying.
I think it's 4 and 4 now. I don't know. It depends on the model, but yeah, I think we have a lot of cores now.
For a Mac application, I'm saying 8 high performance and at least 4 energy efficient cores. Like the core counts are going to be very high. And you know, the whole thing of like that they did one based on A12X and gave them confidence that they could replace Intel. Like, that didn't give them confidence. They knew they could, like, the benchmark numbers for the A12 that they got 3 years ago when the A12 was developed. Like, we all have confidence. We all know they'll do fine, right? Because we keep comparing our iPad and our phone processors against MacBook Pros, and these fanless handheld things with, you know, 7-hour battery life are destroying the Macs in single core and being competitive in multi-core. And the only reason losing multi-core is that maybe they don't have as many cores. If you doubled or tripled the number of cores, these will be amazing processors. So I'm very excited about these chips. Also, I think that the other interesting part is the fact that they're going to have integrated GPU. Now, for a laptop application, you'd say that's a given, right? Because you want a system on a chip type of thing. You want all the energy savings of having it all in one. You don't want discrete GPU. There is a question of how beefy a GPU can you fit in a system on a chip? At what point do you have to go to a discrete GPU? And would Apple consider making a discrete GPU, or would they just continue to ship AMD discrete GPUs in that scenario? To get an idea of how beefy a GPU can you fit in a system on a chip, look at the next generation consoles. Look at the Xbox One and the PlayStation 5. They both have essentially system on a chips that have AMD CPUs and AMD GPUs all in one big thing. And those GPUs that are in there are pretty darn good, right? It's just one big honking chip, but those GPUs are not embarrassing. Arguably, they may be better than my stupid $1,000 video card that I just installed. I haven't looked at the actual benchmarks, but it's pretty impressive. Now, granted, those are big or whatever, but when we're talking about, hey, what kind of ARM system on a chip can you put in an iMac? Could you make an iMac Pro without a discrete GPU? I think it's plausible, especially, you know, if it's a GPU custom tailored to whatever Apple thinks people are going to be doing with an iMac Pro, like Final Cut Pro stuff or whatever, and not necessarily tailored to gaming performance or something like that. You know, for the laptops, it makes much more sense. But for the desktops, I'm still curious. Like, so this just has hints of like, well, they could make, you know, even higher core counts. How many cores could they fit in the power budget of my giant 2019 Mac Pro with these huge fans, right? With no fans, you can do an iPad Pro. If you have, you know, three gigantic fans plus a blower in this huge case, how many cores could you fit in there? That you've got the 28-core Intel thing now that costs a hojillion dollars. I'm pretty sure that you could do like a 64-core ARM CPU for a similar price and power budget. And you know, not that Apple's probably going to make something that big, but boy, that would be a hell of a machine. So I continue to be very excited about Apple's efforts in this area, and I'm glad to see that the rumors are for 12-core things with 8 high-performance core and 4 energy-efficient cores. And I'm also excited that, you know, this, again, makes sense if you think about it, but it's nice to get some confirmation that they're going to use low-power cores. Like, you think, oh, on the phone they have to do that because, you know, it's a handheld device and yada, yada. But it makes perfect sense to do it in laptops as well. You know, Apple's main Mac they sell is laptop, because this will make it so Marco doesn't have to run his little turbo boost disabling thing. It will just run the energy efficient cores almost all the time and reduce power consumption and heat and fan noise and the whole nine yards, and only even turn on the high performance cores when it's called upon to do something big. So boy, this first line of ARM laptops is going to be a hell of a thing, I predict.
I really am looking forward to this.
Same.
Like, I was so happy to see this report, because we've been expecting our Macs are probably somewhere near the, you know, the near term for a while now. I believe we did some kind of bet on the show about when we would see the first ARM Mac, and I believe I said possibly this year. So if this report is true, I'm a little early, but not by much. I'm just so excited about this because, you know, everything John said, like, I think we're going to have a significant improvement in performance per watt. And that's always one of the most exciting, you know, metrics and advances that we can make in computing. You know, making large advances in performance per watt enables new form factors or makes existing form factors way better. You know, like, it enables things like the Apple Watch, which, you know, normally to get that kind of performance would require something larger than what could fit in your wrist until fairly recently in computing history, and now we can do that, right? Phones are amazing. iPads are amazing, all with these extremely low-power chips that can run on these very tiny batteries for many hours at a time while also powering these giant bright screens and cell radios and GPS antennas and stuff like that. So, like, we've made some incredible progress in that area. And whenever there's new progress to be made, it's a big deal. The laptop area has been lagging behind the iPad area pretty badly in this department. There is a lot that the big, beefy Intel architecture is going to be better at for the foreseeable future. Stuff like, you know, I don't think we're going to see a Mac Pro that has a bunch of expansion slots that can run various, like, PC and Mac hybrid hardware cards that's going to run an ARM CPU. Like that, I think anything that's going to involve like Thunderbolt high performance bandwidth, you know, external stuff, or any kind of pro hardware integration, things like, you know, cards and Thunderbolt devices, that's probably going to stay Intel only for the foreseeable future, if not forever, or at least, you know, until those technologies aren't used anymore. But most Apple computers are laptops. Most laptops don't need Thunderbolt 3 for anything, and most people never have a single Thunderbolt peripheral. So most of the time, most people using most Apple computers, most Macs rather, would be totally fine to be served by this. So even if they kept like the iMac Intel and the Mac Pro Intel, they could still have really awesome laptops using ARM, and that would still be a wonderful thing. The GPU issue, I'm actually very excited about because, again, look at most Apple computers sold. We know about 2/3 of them are laptops, and I don't think we know the model breakdown among the laptops, but I think it's pretty safe to assume that most laptops sold are not the 15 or 16-inch class. And if you can assume that, then literally all other models don't have discrete GPUs. Everything else besides the 15 to 16-inch is using integrated GPUs. So to have something really good with awesome, awesome integrated GPU performance and power and size paired with an amazing CPU that is this new architecture that, very power efficient and everything, that's awesome. That covers the vast majority of Apple's computer needs. That's going to be great. And I will be the first person to buy that ARM laptop.
I don't know. I could use a new one.
Yeah, for the discrete GPU use case, like, even though it's a tiny corner of the market, it is a corner of the market that Apple just recently entered with a big splash and presumably wants to continue to be a contender in. They're selling Mac Pros where you can get 4 discrete GPUs. Is it 4? Maybe can you do 8? I forget how many you can put inside this thing. You can put a lot of discrete GPUs, and they've made it a point of saying, and look, we have, if you're using some specific Apple software, we will use all those GPUs. So if Apple wants to stay in that market, and if Apple actually wants to transition that market to ARM anytime soon, they need to have a solution there. The solution could just be just keep using AMD. Like, that's fine. It's a perfectly good solution. Like, their GPUs are great. Maybe Apple doesn't want to deal with that. But for, like Mark was saying, for every other use case, like, there is no problem building a system on a chip with a good enough GPU for even the highest end MacBook Pro. Like, that'll be fine, right? And plus, all those machines all have eGPU support if you really, really need some beefy box outside. And as for bets, I did a search, and I don't know what bet Marco was talking about. The only one I could find, this is a reminder, well, it'll come up in my calendar again, so we won't forget, but on Wednesday, July 1st, Marco contended sometime in our past that the vast majority of models Apple sells will have scissor keyboards. I think he's going to win that bet. I think he already has one.
I think I did win that bet, didn't I?
I don't think anyone was betting against him. I think it was just a prediction, not really a bet. But anyway, July 1st, we will revisit and confirm. Who knows? Maybe they'll go back to butterfly across the board.
Like, unless the 13-inch MacBook Pro sells way better than we think it does, I think I've already won. But even that, I think, yeah. Like, rumor-wise, I'm pretty sure even that is said to switch over, like, any minute now.
I don't know. I'm excited. I really, really hope that this is a thing. And maybe it'll be terrible, for all I know. Maybe I won't be able to run anything on it. Maybe it'll be an absolutely dreadful experience. But sitting here now, where the future is infinite, it does sound amazing. And I don't have any particular angst against Intel, but it certainly seems like Apple is just killing it in the A-series CPUs for mobile stuff. So stands to reason they may be able to do an okay processor for a computer. And I would love to see the output of that team.
All right. Thanks to our sponsor this week, ExpressVPN, and we will talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental. Tech podcast so long.
talking about the fans in my Mac Pro and using iStat menus. And during the show, I realized I had a question about the fan thing. I was looking at my screenshots. In the iStat menu thing, they show the fans. They say one of the fans is the blower fan, which is that one that's on the side, kind of, right?
Yeah, like who's like the RAM slots or whatever?
Yep. And it's a differently designed fan. It's like a, I don't know, it looks like more like a water wheel for air, impeller, or I don't know what the hell it's called. Anyway.
It's called a blower, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then there are the three fans in the front. And iStat menu labels them fan one, fan two, and fan three. And I was trying to determine if me having two GPUs now taking up six slots, the height of six slots in my thing, is that making like the bottom fan run more because that's where the two GPUs are. There used to be one little skinny GPU there, and now there's one gigantic GPU plus the skinny one. But it occurred to me, I don't know which one is fan one, fan two, and fan three. So I did a bunch of Googling, and as you can imagine, this is not an easy Google query to formulate because, you know, anyway. Like, I couldn't find anything telling me whether fan one, fan two. I didn't even know if those were official Apple names. And I thought maybe fan one is the top, fan two is the middle. You know, the only thing I was sure about is fan two is probably the middle one, right? Other than that,
maybe.
I couldn't figure it out. Yeah. So I wrote to the developer and I said, hey, you know, what's fan one, fan two, and fan three? And I also said, is there some place in the app where I could have figured this out? Because I figured maybe they have a diagram somewhere that I couldn't find. And so if you take a look in the Slack channel, it's a picture I just posted. This is the picture that was attached to the email that I got back from the iStat menu.
Oh, no.
This is making me uncomfortable. So
and
I'm
so the
at-
what the email says is... in our testing, please see attached. We've concluded that fan three is the top fan. So the photograph is of a Mac Pro with a wooden stick poking into it. The wooden stick presumably stopping the top fan and then seeing which one of the RPMs drops to zero.
I was going to suggest, like, why don't you just hold your finger on the axle of each one? But I would never have done that to my own, because, like,
yeah,
that's probably going to burn out a motor at some point. Like, you don't want to do that if you don't have to.
I did that to my Synology recently, because I was down there. I was down in the basement long enough to be annoyed by the Synology fan noise. I'm like, is one of my fans going bad? Let me just stop one of the fans just to see if, like, that's the one that's making the noise, because there's multiple fans. And, boy, the fans in my Synology are very powerful. They snapped the toothpick right in half. I stuck a toothpick in there to stop the fan. They were like, toothpick? Forget about that. Anyway.
No, you're supposed to like stick your finger on the axle of the fan.
Yeah, I know. I was doing it without disassembling it, so it's kind of hard to get to the grating. Yeah. You know, I couldn't really. So I'd use the tooth. Anyway. But yeah, I would not have the guts to try this experiment. So thank you, iStat menu developers, for destroying your own Mac Pro to let me know. But honestly, it's your software. You should be able to figure out whether fan one is the top one without doing this. So yeah, like I said, the answer is that fan three is the top fan, but then he says they're probably going to they'll think about renaming them to make it clearer in the actual shipping application. This is still a beta that has Mac Pro support.
By the way, I can't speak for the beta, but in iStat menus that I'm running, if you open the preferences, there's global on the left at the top and there's a pause button next to it. If you pause that, iStat menu stops.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Sure it does. Go run Kexload and see if the kernel is dead.
Oh, my God.
The other thing I realized when I was playing Destiny is, like, a cool thing happened when I was playing. I'm like, how do I save that? Oh, I'm not recording all the time like I am on the PlayStation. Win for dedicated hardware. The PlayStation is always recording. Always be recording. It is literally always recording. So I don't have to remember before to record my gameplay. After I do something cool, I can just say, save that. And when I did something cool on my quote-unquote PC, it's gone. Because I wasn't recording. As far as I know, it's not recording. I know Steam has some game capture recording thing that I managed to bring up, but it's like, but it's too late. It's after the fact. So many overlays in PC gaming. So many overlays.
Yeah, whenever I launch Minecraft on Tiff's gaming PC, it tells me this thing about the Xbox game bar. I'm like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. What the hell is this? What are you doing? Why? What?
It's got a social thing. It's got a bunch of stuff in there for like capture and stuff. So it's nice that there's like a system level, you know, or it's Steam the way I'm using it. But it's nice that there are sort of meta gaming products that no matter what game you're playing can do a cool thing for it. But just you have so much crap on your screen. You've already got the game UI and then you've got the Steam UI and then you've got the game bar. And
I when we were talking about my Minecraft, you know, starting, and I had to get a screenshot, like you told me to take a screenshot of what I had built and make it the chapter art. So I'm running around, mm-hmm. like right before publishing the show, trying to get a screenshot. And I used the Xbox Game Bar or whatever on the PC to just capture the screenshot. First of all, figuring that out was non-trivial. And then to try to figure out, okay, where did it save the file? As someone who doesn't remember a lot about Windows, and I mean, you know, the last version of Windows I used extensively was Windows XP, and that was a very long time ago. I had no clue where to even begin to look. It took me forever to find where the heck it put this file. It was totally non-obvious. Like, it's funny, as like when I use the PC, I get a slight glimpse into like what it must be like to be a normal person using a PC, like who's not a computer nerd, because I'm so unfamiliar with this platform that lots of other people are totally familiar with. I feel like I'm such a noob and I don't know what I'm doing and everything is confusing. Nothing makes sense. I do everything very carefully and gingerly because I don't want to break it. Like right now, like we're kind of alternating between the Minecraft Bedrock edition because we play some games that use that and the Java edition because like, we play on a server that uses that. And I have both installed and I have both icons in whatever the start bar is called these days. Both of them next to each other. They have very similar icons. All I want to do is rename one of them to say Minecraft Bedrock Edition and rename the other one to say Minecraft Java Edition. I cannot for the life of me figure out how to rename things in this bar. And I just gave up. I'm like, all right, fine. I'll just know like the one on the left is this and the one on the right is this. And it's exactly the kind of like failure of computer usage that we as nerds, we see other people doing that. We're like, oh, what a shame. They could be making this so much better if they just, you know, held down control and right click this and hit F4 or whatever. Like, and we know all those things, but no one else does. Now I'm kind of getting a taste of that.
Yeah, I've been, you know, my brief forays into Windows 10, mostly just trying to make sure that the sound is going to the right place and to make sure the drivers are hooked up and stuff like that. The Windows 10, like the shell that's covering the deep internal guts of Windows XP still lurking or Windows 7 still lurking under there, whatever. It's mostly faked me out. Like, I don't like the interface, but in general, their search is good and I can find what I'm looking for pretty easily. When I installed the new drivers for my video card, of course, like every PC thing, there's some weird ass application that comes with the drivers, like AMD settings. And it's like this weird, like it looks weird. It's got a custom UI. It's like brushed metal, like all custom everything. And it's like, do you really need an entire, I guess AMD probably does for, you know, formerly ATI for their video cards, but like it's this whole other world of places you can screw with your video card, including a tab that has some acronym that I didn't recognize that as soon as you click on it, it says, warning, you can damage your monitor by changing these settings. I'm like, all right, nope.
not that monitor.
I don't know what that is, but I'm not going to that tab. Like, you can change everything in these weird custom apps. You know. And then, of course, I had that open at the same time as I had the Microsoft Displays setting open. It's like, what if I change like something over here? Like, if I change the bit depth or if I change the resolution, will it reflect on the other UI? Probably not. So I just, you know, again, like, you're being very careful. Just back away. Just close one of the applications. If you're about to change resolution, just do it in one place. In fact, don't even have that application running. The other thing, the only thing that's driving me nuts about Windows in the brief time that I'm using it is like, let's say I download these AMD drivers. It's the typical Windows browser thing where it gives you that dialogue that has evolved over the years, but it's still basically the same, which is the option is open, run. Like, what do you want me to do with this download, right? You know, one of the options is just like, let it download. It's okay for this download. The other one is like, show me the folder after it's finished downloading. And the final one is, actually launch the thing after it finishes downloading. And I, you know, it's if it's a, I'm downloading drivers, they just launch it, because if I don't launch it like Marco, I won't know where the hell it is. So just run it.
That's what most people do, because they don't know where the hell it is either.
Right. But like the running thing, I think what ran, it ran like the unzip process or something. It basically threw me into an Explorer window that showed me like a folder. I'm like, oh, well, I guess it extracted it. So I go into the folder and there's setup.exe, right? I double click setup.exe. And I'm always like, oh, I didn't adjust the double click settings. Maybe I didn't double click fast enough, because I double click and it seems like nothing happens. like nothing happens, right? And so I right click and select open. And I must have done this over the time that I've had this Mac Pro messing boot camp like 5 times. This happens all the time. What happens is eventually, like the thing setup, you know, the setup thing comes on the screen and has a next button. I'm going to the wizard. Halfway through the wizard, I get a dialog box that comes up that says, sorry, another copy of this application is already running. That's the second right-click open happening, right? The open takes so long to run, and there's no visual feedback that, yeah, my first double-click did work, and so did my right-click open. And one of them ran and I'm interacting with it, and the second one finally launches and says, oh, I can't run because it's another copy of me running. If you're lucky, that happens. If you're unlucky, a second copy runs, and then you're like, I don't know what the hell's going on. But like, I came to appreciate the dock and the stupid bouncy icons, because if there is some visual indication in the default Windows 10 UI that I have successfully double-clicked a thing, I can't find it. And if your thing doesn't immediately throw a window up on the screen, you have no idea whether you successfully double-clicked it. And that seems like a basic thing.
I have found, like, in my, you know, admittedly very minimal usage of Windows here, I have been able to find most setting that I had to change or wanted to change. But the process of finding settings is kind of soul-crushing, because...
It's like web search.
Yeah, well, because there's so much complexity still in Windows, because, you know, just a combination of... You know, lots of inherent complexity in what Windows is, but also lots of legacy complexity in what Windows was and always has been. And so they have like all sorts of different levels and screens and modes and different settings windows and panes and everything. Nobody can find anything. And they know this. And so the process of trying to change the setting in Windows feels almost like a touchtone menu on a phone. It's like, all right. What kind of thing do you want to do? Here's a bunch of very long text descriptions that you have to read about all the different areas and modes you might want to try. And then it's just like a wall of text everywhere you go that is not what you want, but it's more like a pointer to what you want. It's like explaining like, okay, well, here's the kind of category that we have over in this department. Click here to be quick linked over to that department, and we'll transfer you there, and they can keep helping you. You click on that link, and then you go to the next department. Okay, here's another giant wall of text. What kind of thing within this department do you want to do? And eventually, you go through two or three of those, and eventually, it opens up some kind of actual settings pane. That like, it's so weird, and that is one approach. Like, if you have massive complexity and huge amounts of layers and layers upon layers of legacy and cruft, one approach is to just throw walls of text at people to try to get them to successfully navigate it, and that will work to some degree. It's incredibly inelegant, but it does kind of sort of work. I guess a better approach would be just try to get rid of a lot of that complexity, but they don't seem like the entire OS feels so designed by committee at this point that that's never going to happen. So I'm just enjoying the ride of whenever I have to change anything in Windows, like, all right, how do I do it? Well, let me just go talk to the committee and they will transfer me to the other committee, and eventually somebody will send me in the right direction.
I appreciate the options when I'm in the game stuff, like that game bar thing that I mentioned I brought up. One of the things that it brings up is an audio panel that I would have killed for on my PlayStation, even. Like, it's an audio panel that said, here's your master volume, here's the volume of the Steam application, here's the game volume, here's the voice chat volume, here's the mix between them. It was just like, yes, that's every setting I'll ever want to change. Because, you know, when you're playing a game, if you're trying to play a game and you're streaming, you have voice chat, and like... just one volume control is not enough. You always want to adjust all the volumes and all the different things. And here it was, one little panel that had sliders for literally every single volume, including mixes between stuff. And on PlayStation even, which has settings for that, you got to go back to the system menu, then go into the thing and scroll down and adjust this thing here, but then make sure this chat is going through that. But then in the game, it has its own set of settings. This had one little floating window, granted, in this giant set of overlay things, that had all the adjustments on it. And forget about it on the Mac. You have like system volume and that's it. Maybe you have separate volume settings in the game itself. This was like, no matter what game you're playing, these are all the volume settings that you can deal with. I was very impressed. Like, everything's better when it comes to gaming over on PC. Other than actually having to boot Windows, that is. Of course. God, continues to be a challenge. Black screens, like, I hate every time I have to disconnect my LG monitor from my PlayStation. It's such a pain with the stupid power brick and the power cord and getting an HDMI cable and dragging it over here. And it's just wish it would just work. Oh, and the other weird thing is, when I wanted to reboot, I set my startup disk to be Windows just because I was rebooting so many times and I didn't want to like have to hold on option to pick the drive. I just wanted to default boot off Windows. Then eventually, I'm like, okay, well, I'm done with that. I disconnected my Windows drive, put it away, and then I boot, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to boot back into macOS. And it booted, and it was like grinding my hard drive like crazy, like my spinning hard drive. I'm like, what are you doing, hard drive? Like, so much so that it was like beach balling, and I couldn't even get a right click to eject the thing. I was like, why are you, like, is Spotlight trying to index my drive? Why is it even mounting? Shouldn't it be auto? I had a bunch of stuff set to not mount and blah, blah, blah. And eventually, I think I figured out that what it had done was booted onto my spinning disk super duper clone. Let me tell you, ooh, don't do that. it worked. Like, the fact that it took me a while to notice, but mostly what I noticed was that incredible noise. And it's like, that's my boot disk. It's grinding my boot disk. Like, because I think it was probably Spotlight indexing or preparing a Time Machine backup of my boot disk. Boy, what a racket. So yeah, rebooted into the SSD. It's way quieter.
See, hopefully when this ARM transition finally happens, it will finally force you to just get a freaking gaming PC and separate these roles so you can stop doing all these crazy hacks.
Seems like I already have one, as evidenced from my Destiny gameplay experience today. And as we know, that's the only game that I care about playing. So I think I'm all set on the gaming PC front. The only thing I could wish for is I would like it if my PlayStation controllers were wireless, but that's not a Mac-specific thing. I think it's just a Steam thing. I haven't quite figured out how to get that to work yet. But yeah, it was pretty good. The only problem is that cheating is more rampant on PC for obvious reasons, and that's kind of annoying. And B, people are a little bit better on PC, and that makes me feel worse.
You know, we know some people who are very, you know, extreme or specialized or really good at certain things. Like our friend underscore David Smith, I think he might be the person in the world who has made the most apps for the Apple Watch, including people who work for Apple on the Apple Watch team. I think he has almost certainly spent the most time total writing watchOS apps compared to probably anyone else in the world. Do you think you might be the only person in the world who is using a 2020 Mac Pro as a gaming PC?
I'm not using it as a gaming PC. I played some games on it. And no, I'm not the only one playing some games. I guarantee that everybody who has one of these things who doesn't need it for legitimate purposes is playing games on it in Windows at some point.
Really?
Why else would they have it?
Do you think, are there many people who buy this computer just for the heck of it besides like you and Max?
I don't think there's a lot of them, but how many people do you know? We know me, Stephen Hackett, Quinn Nelson. Right? That's three people right there. You know, it's a small group, but it's not like they don't exist.
You might be the only person using that computer as a gaming PC.
I just played a game on it. I'm not using it as a gaming PC. I'm not the only person.
No, like what I mean by that is, you know, installing Boot Camp and running Windows games on it on a regular basis.
It's not a regular basis. Like, before it wasn't because my GPU was crappy. Now I have a decision. Probably mostly what's going to happen is I'm going to continue to play on the PlayStation just because I don't want to reboot my beautiful Mac because it is painful to reboot in Windows, but it was definitely cool. And you know, I'm like Mac games, I'm now much more interested in too, because now I have the ability to play them. But honestly, I don't think there's many Mac games that would challenge my gaming PCs, even the old GPU.
Yeah.
No, I'm not the only one, but yes, there are dozens of us, right? So, but maybe not more than dozens.
Yeah, probably not. I can't imagine.
All right, Casey's going to turn into a pumpkin. We have to let him go to sleep.
All right.
I'm still here. I'm fine.
But you're so sad. And you don't even know if your garage door is closed. He's got a lot of on his mind right now.
I know. It's terrible. the funny thing is, I can look on the app to see if it's open or closed. So let me look.
Wait.
And this app is so fucking bad.
You can just open the app and check?
Yeah, but I want a little LED that shines.
Oh, my God. That this whole time, that could have been the solution?
Now you have to cut this whole segment.
Oh, my God.
No, he's going to drop this in at the end.
He left out the most salient, idiotic piece of information. He's going to set up a phone with an old iPod Touch with the app always running and point a camera at it and use machine learning to figure out. And the boot will knock over the fishbowl. The cat will chase the fish.
Clearly the easier way of accomplishing this. Why would I do anything
else?
Light
the candle that'll burst the balloon and send the trolley on its way.
I said from the get-go this was overkill. I said it from the get-go.